The Deer Slayer. Chapter 1. There is a pleasure in the pathless woods, there is a rapture on the lonely shore. There is society where none intrudes, by the deep sea, and music in its roar, I love not man the less, but nature more. From these are interviews, in which I steal from all I may be, or have been before, to mingle with the universe, and feel what I can ne'er express, yet cannot all conceal. Childe Harold. On the human imagination events produce the effects of time. Thus, he who has travelled far and seen much is apt to fancy that he has lived long, and the history that most abounds in important incidents soonest assumes the aspect of antiquity. In no other way can we account for the venerable air that is already gathering around American annals. When the mind reverts to the earliest days of colonial history, the period seems remote and obscure, the thousand changes that thicken along the links of recollections, throwing back the origin of the nation to a day so distant as seemingly to reach the mists of time, and yet four lives of ordinary duration would suffice to transmit, from mouth to mouth, in the form of tradition, all that civilized man has achieved within the limits of the Republic. Although New York alone possesses a population materially exceeding that of either of the four smallest kingdoms of Europe, or materially exceeding that of the entire Swiss Confederation, it is little more than two centuries since the Dutch commenced their settlement, rescuing the region from the savage state. Thus, what seems venerable by an accumulation of changes is reduced to familiarity when we come seriously to consider it solely in connection with time. This glance into the perspective of the past will prepare the reader to look at the pictures we are about to sketch, with less surprise than he might otherwise feel, and a few additional explanations may carry him back in imagination to the precise condition of society that we desire to delineate. It is matter of history that the settlements on the eastern shores of the Hudson, such as Claverick, Kinderhook, and even Poughkeepsie, were not regarded as safe from Indian incursions a century since, and there is still standing on the banks of the same river, and within musket shot of the wharves of Albany, a residence of a younger branch of the Van Rensselaers, that has loopholes constructed for defense against the same crafty enemy, although it dates from a period scarcely so distant. Other similar memorials of the infancy of the country are to be found, scattered through what is now deemed the very center of American civilization, affording the plainest proofs that all we possess of security from invasion and hostile violence is the growth of but little more than the time that is frequently fulfilled by a single human life. The incidents of this tale occurred between the years 1740 and 1745, when the settled portions of the colony of New York were confined to the four Atlantic counties, a narrow belt of country on each side of the Hudson, extending from its mouth to the falls near its head, and to a few advanced neighborhoods on the Mohawk and the Schoharie. Broad belts of the virgin wilderness not only reached the shores of the first river, but they even crossed it, stretching away into New England, and affording forest covers to the noiseless moccasin of the native warrior, as he trod the secret and bloody warpath. A bird's-eye view of the whole region east of the Mississippi must then have offered one vast expanse of woods, relieved by a comparatively narrow fringe of cultivation along the sea, dotted by the glittering surfaces of lakes, and intersected by the waving lines of river. In such a vast picture of solemn solitude, the district of country we design to paint sinks into insignificance, though we feel encouraged to proceed by the conviction that, with slight and immaterial distinctions, he who succeeds in giving an accurate idea of any portion of this wild region must necessarily convey a tolerably correct notion of the whole. Whatever may be the changes produced by man, the eternal round of the seasons is unbroken. Summer and winter, seed time and harvest, return in their stated order with a sublime precision, affording to man one of the noblest of all the occasions he enjoys of proving the high powers of his far-reaching mind, encompassing the laws that control their exact uniformity, and in calculating their never-ending revolutions. Centuries of summer suns had warmed the tops of the same noble oaks and pines, sending their heats even to the tenacious roots, when voices were heard calling to each other, in the depths of a forest, of which the leafy surface lay bathed in the brilliant light of a cloudless day in June, while the trunks of the trees rose in gloomy grandeur in the shades beneath. The calls were in different tones, evidently proceeding from two men who had lost their way, and were searching in different directions for their path. At length a shout proclaimed success, and presently a man of gigantic mold broke out of the tangled labyrinth of a small swamp, emerging into an opening that appeared to have been formed partly by the ravages of the wind, and partly by those of fire. This little area, which afforded a good view of the sky, although it was pretty well filled with dead trees, lay on the side of one of the high hills, or low mountains, into which nearly the whole surface of the adjacent country was broken. "Here is room to breathe in," exclaimed the liberated forester, as soon as he found himself under a clear sky, shaking his huge frame like a mastiff that has just escaped from a snowbank. "Hurrah! Deerslayer, here is daylight, at last, and yonder is the lake. These words were scarcely uttered when the second forester dashed aside the bushes of the swamp and appeared in the area. After making a hurried adjustment of his arms and disordered dress, he joined his companion, who had already begun his disposition for a halt. "Do you know this spot?" demanded the one called Deerslayer, "or do you shout at the sight of the sun?"
"Both, lad, both, I know the spot, and am not sorry to see so useful a friend as the sun. Now we have got the pints of the compass in our minds once more, and 'tis will be our own faults if we let anything turn them topsy-turvy again, as has just happened. My name is not Hurry Harry, if this be not the very spot where the land hunters camped the last summer, and passed a week. See, I yonder are the dead bushes of their bower, and here is the spring. Much as I like the sun, boy, I've no occasion for it to tell me it is noon. This stomach of mine is as good a timepiece as is to be found in the colony, and it already pints to 12:30. So open the wallet, and let us wind up for another 6 hours' run." At this suggestion, both set themselves about making the preparations necessary for their usual frugal but hearty meal. We will profit by this pause in the discourse to give the reader some idea of the appearance of the men, each of whom is destined to enact no insignificant part in our legend. It would not have been easy to find a more noble specimen of vigorous manhood than was offered in the person of him who called himself Hurry Harry. His real name was Henry March, but the frontiersmen having caught the practice of giving sobriquets from the Indians, the appellation of Hurry was far oftener applied to him than his proper designation, and not unfrequently he was termed Hurry Scurry, a nickname he had obtained from a dashing, reckless offhand manner, and a physical restlessness that kept him so constantly on the move, as to cause him to be known along the whole line of scattered habitations that lay between the province and the Canadas. The stature of Hurry Harry exceeded 6'4", and being unusually well proportioned, his strength fully realized the idea created by his gigantic frame. The face did no discredit to the rest of the man, for it was both good-humored and handsome. His air was free, and though his manner necessarily partook of the rudeness of a border life, the grandeur that pervaded so noble a physique prevented it from becoming altogether vulgar. Deerslayer, as Hurry called his companion, was a very different person in appearance, as well as in character. In stature he stood about 6 feet in his moccasins, but his frame was comparatively light and slender, showing muscles, however, that promised unusual agility, if not unusual strength. His face would have had little to recommend it except youth, were it not for an expression that seldom failed to win upon those who had leisure to examine it, and to yield to the feeling of confidence it created. This expression was simply that of guileless truth, sustained by an earnestness of purpose, and a sincerity of feeling, that rendered it remarkable. At times this air of integrity seemed to be so simple as to awaken the suspicion of a one of the usual means to discriminate between artifice and truth, but few came in serious contact with the man, without losing this distrust and respect for his opinions and motives. Both these frontiersmen were still young, Hurry having reached the age of 6 or 8 and 20, while Deerslayer was several years his junior. Their attire needs no particular description, though it may be well to add that it was composed in no small degree of dressed deerskins, and had the usual signs of belonging to those who pass their time between the skirts of civilized society and the boundless forests. There was, notwithstanding, some attention to smartness and the picturesque in the arrangements of Deerslayer's dress, more particularly in the part connected with his arms and accoutrements. His rifle was in perfect condition, the handle of his hunting knife was neatly carved, his powder horn was ornamented with suitable devices lightly cut into the material, and his shot pouch was decorated with wampum. On the other hand, Hurry Harry, either from constitutional recklessness, or from a secret consciousness how little his appearance required artificial aids, wore everything in a careless, slovenly manner, as if he felt a noble scorn for the trifling accessories of dress and ornaments. Perhaps the peculiar effect of his fine form and great stature was increased rather than lessened, by this unstudied and disdainful air of indifference. "Come, Deerslayer, fall to, and prove that you have a Delaware stomach, as you say you have had a Delaware education," cried Hurry, setting the example by opening his mouth to receive a slice of cold venison steak that would have made an entire meal for a European peasant. "Fall to, lad, and prove your manhood on this poor devil of a doe with your teeth, as you've already done with your rifle." "Nay, nay, Hurry, there's little manhood in killing a doe, and that too out of season, though there might be some in bringing down a painter or a catamount," returned the other, disposing himself to comply. "The Delawares have given me my name, not so much on account of a bold heart, as on account of a quick eye, and an active foot. There may not be any cowardice in overcoming a deer, but certain it is, there's no great valor."
"The Delawares themselves are no heroes," muttered Hurry through his teeth, the mouth being too full to permit it to be fairly opened,
or they would never have allowed them loping vagabonds, the Mingos, to make them women. That matter is not rightly understood has never been rightly explained, said Deerslayer earnestly, for he was as zealous a friend as his companion was dangerous as an enemy. The Mengwe fill the woods with their lies, and misconstruct words and treaties. I have now lived 10 years with the Delawares, and know them to be as manful as any other nation, when the proper time to strike comes. Harkee, Master Deerslayer, since we are on the subject, we may as well open our minds to each other in a man-to-man way. Answer me one question. You have had so much luck among the game as to have gotten a title, it would seem, but did you ever hit anything human or intelligible? Did you ever pull trigger on an enemy that was capable of pulling one upon you? This question produced a singular collision between mortification and correct feeling, in the bosom of the youth, that was easily to be traced in the workings of his ingenuous countenance. The struggle was short, however, uprightness of heart soon getting the better of false pride and frontier boastfulness. To own the truth, I never did, answered Deerslayer, seeing that a fitting occasion never offered. The Delawares have been peaceable since my sojourn with them, and I hold it to be unlawful to take the life of man, except in open and generous warfare. What? Did you never find a fellow thieving among your traps and skins, and do the law on him with your own hands, by way of saving the magistrates trouble in the settlements, and the rogue himself the cost of the suit? I am no trapper, Hurry, returned the young man proudly. I live by the rifle, a weapon at which I will not turn my back on any man of my years, atween the Hudson and the St. Lawrence. I never offer a skin that has not a hole in its head besides them which nature made to see with or to breathe through. This is all very well, in the animal way, though it makes but a poor figure alongside of scalps and ambushes. Shooting an Indian from an ambush is acting up to his own principles, and now we have what you call a lawful war on our hands. The sooner you wipe that disgrace off your character, the sounder will be your sleep, if it only come from knowing there is one enemy the less prowling in the woods. I shall not frequent your society long, friend Natty, unless you look higher than four-footed beasts to practice your rifle on. Our journey is nearly ended, you say, Master March, and we can part tonight, if you see occasion. I have a friend waiting for me, who will think it no disgrace to consort with a fellow creature that has never yet slain his kind. I wish I knew what has brought that skulking Delaware into this part of the country so early in the season, muttered Hurry to himself, in a way to show equally distrust and a recklessness of its betrayal. Where did you say the young chief was to give you the meeting? At a small round rock, near the foot of the lake, where they tell me, the tribes are given to resorting to make their treaties, and to bury their hatchets. This rock have I often heard the Delawares mention. The lake and rock are equally strangers to me. The country is claimed by both Mingos and Mohicans, and is a sort of common territory to fish and hunt through, in time of peace, though what it may become in wartime, the Lord only knows. Common territory, exclaimed Hurry, laughing aloud. I should like to know what Floating Tom Hunter would say to that. He claims the lake as his own property, in virtue of 15 years' possession, and will not be likely to give it up to either Mingo or Delaware without a battle for it. And what will the colony say to such a quarrel? All this country must have some owner, the gentry pushing their cravings into the wilderness, even where they never dare to venture, in their own persons, to look at the land they own. That may do in other quarters of the colony, Deerslayer, but it will not do here. Not a human being, the Lord excepted, owns a foot of soil in this part of the country. Pen was never put to paper concerning either hill or valley hereaway, as I've heard old Tom say time and again, and so he claims the best right to it of any man breathing, and what Tom claims, he'll be very likely to maintain. By what I've heard you say, Hurry, this Floating Tom must be an uncommon mortal, neither Mingo Delaware, nor Paleface. His possession, too, has been long, by your tell, and altogether beyond frontier endurance. What's the man's history and nature? Why, as to old Tom's human nature, it is not much like other men's human nature, but more like a muskrat's human natar, seeing that he takes more to the ways of that animal than to the ways of any other fellow creature. Some think he was a free liver on the salt water, in his youth, and a companion of a sartain kid, who was hanged for piracy, long afore you and I were born or acquainted, and that he came up into these regions, thinking that the king's cruisers could never cross the mountains, and that he might enjoy the plunder peaceably in the woods. Then he was wrong, Hurry, very wrong. A man can enjoy plunder peaceably nowhere. That's much as his turn of mind may happen to be. I've known them that never could enjoy it at all, unless it was in the midst of a jollification, and them again that enjoyed it best in a corner. Some men have no peace if they don't find plunder, and some if they do. Human nature is crooked in these matters. Old Tom seems to belong to neither set, as he enjoys his, If plunder he has really got, with his darters, in a very quiet and comfortable way, and wishes for no more. A, he has darters, too, I've heard the Delawares, who've hunted this away, tell their histories of these young women. Is there no mother, hurry? There was once, as in reason, but she has now been dead and sunk these 2 good years. Anon? Said Deerslayer, looking up at his companion in a little surprise. Dead and sunk, I say, and I hope that's good English. The old fellow lowered his wife into the lake, by way of seeing the last of her, as I can testify, being an eyewitness of the ceremony, but whether Tom did it to save digging, which is no easy job among roots, or out of a can say that water washes away sin sooner than earth, is more than I can say. Was the poor woman uncommon wicked, that her husband should take so much pains with her body? Not unreasonable, though she had her faults. I consider Judith Hutter to have been as graceful, and about as likely to make a good end as any woman who had lived so long beyond the sound of church bells, and I conclude old Tom sunk her as much by way of saving pains, as by way of taking it. There was a little steel in her temper, it's true, and, as old Hutter is pretty much Flynn, they struck out sparks once and a while, but, on the whole, they might be said to live amicable-like. When they did kindle, the listeners got some such insights into their past lives, as one gets into the darker parts of the woods, when a stray gleam of sunshine finds its way down to the roots of the trees. But Judith I shall always esteem, as it's recommend enough to one woman to be the mother of such a creature as her daughter, Judith Hutter. A. Judith was the name the Delawares mentioned, though it was pronounced after a fashion of their own. From their discourse, I do not think the girl would much please my fancy. Thy fancy! Exclaimed March, taking fire equally at the indifference and at the presumption of his companion, what the devil have you to do with a fancy, and that, too, concerning one like Judith? You are but a boy, a sapling, that has scarce got root. Judith has had men among her suitors, ever since she was 15, which is now near 5 years, and will not be apt even to cast a look upon a half-grown creature like you. It is June, and there is not a cloud atween us and the sun, hurry, so all this heat is not wanted, answered the other, altogether undisturbed. Anyone may have a fancy, and a squirrel has a right to make up his mind touching a catamount. A, but it might not be wise, always, to let the catamount know it, growled March. But you're young and thoughtless, and I'll overlook your ignorance. Come, Deerslayer, he added, with a good-natured laugh, after pausing a moment to reflect, come, Deerslayer, we are sworn friends, and will not quarrel about a light-minded, jilting jade, just because she happens to be handsome, more especially as you have never seen her. Judith is only for a man whose teeth show the full marks, and it's foolish to be afeard of a boy. What did the Delaware say of the hussy? For an Indian, after all, has his notions of womankind, as well as a white man. They said she was fair to look on, and pleasant of speech, but overgiven to admirers, and light-minded. They are devils incarnate. After all, what schoolmaster is a match for an Indian, in looking into nature? Some people think they are only good on a trail or the warpath, but I say that they are philosophers, and understand a man as well as they understand a beaver, and a woman as well as they understand either. Now that's Judith's character to a ribbon. To own the truth to you, Deerslayer, I should have married the gal 2 years since, if it had not been for 2 particular things, one of which was this very light-mindedness. And what may have been the other? Demanded the hunter, who continued to eat like one that took very little interest in the subject. T'other was an uncertainty about her having me. The hussy is handsome, and she knows it. Boy, not a tree that is growing in these hills is straighter, or waves in the wind with an easier bend, nor did you ever see the doe that bounded with a more natural motion. If that was all, every tongue would sound her praises, but she has such failings that I find it hard to overlook them, and sometimes I swear I'll never visit the lake again. Which is the reason that you always come back. Nothing is ever made more sure by swearing about it. Ah, Deerslayer, you are a novelty in these particulars, keeping as true to education as if you had never left the settlements. With me the case is different, and I never wanted a clinch any day, that I do not feel a wish to swear about it. If you note all that I know concerning Judith, you'd find a justification for a little cussing. Now, the officers sometimes stray over to the lake, from the forts on the Mohawk, to fish and hunt, and then the creature seems beside herself. You can see in the manner which she wears her finery, and the airs she gives herself with the gallants. That is unseemly in a poor man's daughter, returned Deerslayer gravely, the officers are all gentry, and can only look on such as Judith with evil intentions. There's the uncertainty, and the damper. I have my misgivings about a particular captain, and Jude has no one to blame but her own folly, if I'm right. On the whole, I wish to look upon her as modest and becoming, and yet the clouds that drive among these hills are not more uncertain. Not a dozen white men have ever laid eyes upon her since she was a child, and yet her heirs, with two or three of these officers, are extinguishers. I would think no more of such a woman, but turn my mind altogether to the forest, that will not deceive you, being ordered and ruled by a hand that never wavers. If you know Judith, you would see how much easier it is to say this than it would be to do it. Could I bring my mind to be easy about the officers, I would carry the gal off to the Mohawk by force, make her marry me in spite of her whiffling, and leave old Tom to the care of Hetty, his other child, who, if she be not as handsome or as quick-witted as her sister, is much the most dutiful. Is there another bird in the same nest? Asked Deerslayer, raising his eyes with a species of half-awakened curiosity. The Delaware spoke to me only of one. That's natural enough, when Judith Hutter and Hetty Hutter are in question. Hetty is only comely, while her sister, I tell thee, boy, is such another as is not to be found atween this and the sea. Judith is as full of wit, and talk, and cunning, as an old Indian order, while poor Hetty is at the best but compass met us. Anon? Inquired, again, the Deerslayer. Why, what the officers call compass mentis, which I understand to signify that she means always to go in the right direction, but sometimes does not know how. Compass for the pint, and mentis for the intention. No, poor Hetty is what I call on the verge of ignorance, and sometimes she stumbles on one side of the line, and sometimes on t'other. Them are beings that the Lord has in his special care, said Deerslayer, solemnly, for he looks carefully to all who fall short of their proper share of reason. The Redskins honor and respect them who are so gifted, knowing that the evil spirit delights more to dwell in an artful body, than in one that has no cunning to work upon. I'll answer for it, then, that he will not remain long with poor Hetty, for the child is just compass mentis, as I have told you. Old Tom has a feeling for the gal, and so has Judith, quick-witted and glorious as she is herself, else would I not answer for her being altogether safe among the sort of men that sometimes meet on the lake shore. I thought this water an unknown and little frequented sheet, observed the Deerslayer, evidently uneasy at the idea of being too near the world. It's all that, lad, the eyes of 20 white men never having been laid on it, still, 20 true-bred frontiersmen hunters and trappers, and scouts, and the like, can do a deal of mischief if they try. T would be an awful thing to me, Deerslayer, did I find Judith married, after an absence of 6 months. Have you the gal's faith, to encourage you to hope otherwise? Not at all. I know not how it is, I'm good-looking, boy, that much I can see in any spring on which the sun shines, and yet I could not get the hussy to a promise, or even a cordial willing smile, though she will laugh by the hour. If she has dared to marry in my absence, she'd be like to know the pleasures of widowhood afore she is 20. You would not harm the man she has chosen, hurry, simply because she found him more to her liking than yourself. Why not? If an enemy crosses my path, will I not beat him out of it? Look at me. Am I a man like to let any sneaking, crawling, skin trader get the better of me in a matter that touches me as near as the kindness of Judith Hutter? Besides, when we live beyond law, we must be our own judges and executioners. And if a man should be found dead in the woods, who is there to say who slew him, even admitting that the colony took the matter in hand and made a stir about it? If that man should be Judith Hutter's husband, after what has passed, I might tell enough, at least, to put the colony on the trail. You, half-grown, venison-hunting bantling. You dare to think of informing against Hurry Harry in so much as a matter touching a mink or a woodchuck. I would dare to speak truth, Hurry, concerning you or any man that ever lived. March looked at his companion, for a moment, in silent amazement, then seizing him by the throat with both hands, he shook his comparatively slight frame with a violence that menaced the dislocation of some of the bones. Nor was this done jocularly, for anger flashed from the giant's eyes, and there were certain signs that seemed to threaten much more earnestness than the occasion would appear to call for. Whatever might be the real intention of March, and it is probable there was none settled in his mind, it is certain that he was unusually aroused, and most men who found themselves throttled by one of a mold so gigantic, in such a mood, and in a solitude so deep and helpless, would have felt intimidated, and tempted to yield even the right. Not so, however, with Deerslayer. His countenance remained unmoved, his hand did not shake, and his answer was given in a voice that did not resort to the artifice of louder tones, even by way of proving its owner's resolution. You may shake, Hurry, until you bring down the mountain, he said quietly, but nothing beside truth will you shake from me. It is probable that Judith Hutter has no husband to slay, and you may never have a chance to waylay one, Else would I tell her of your threat, in the first conversation I held with the Gaul. March released his grip, and sat regarding the other in silent astonishment. I thought we had been friends, he at length added, but you've got the last secret of mine that will ever enter your ears. I want none, if they are to be like this. I know we live in the woods, hurry, and are thought to be beyond human laws, and perhaps we are so, in fact, whatever it may be in right, but there is a law and a lawmaker, that rule across the whole continent. He that flies in the face of either need not call me a friend. Dama, Deerslayer, if I do not believe you are at heart a Moravian, and no fair-minded, plain-dealing hunter, as you've pretended to be. Fair-minded or not, hurry, you will find me as plain-dealing in deeds as I am in words. But this giving way to sudden anger is foolish, and proves how little you have sojourned with the red man. Judith Hutter no doubt is still single, and you spoke but as the tongue ran, and not as the heart felt. There's my hand, and we will say and think no more about it. Hurry seemed more surprised than ever. Then he burst forth in a loud, good-natured laugh, which brought tears to his eyes. After this he accepted the offered hand, and the parties became friends. "T would have been foolish to quarrel about any day," March cried, as he resumed his meal, "and more like lawyers in the towns than like sensible men in the woods. They tell me, Deerslayer, much ill blood grows out of a day among the people in the lower counties, and that they sometimes get to extremities upon them." "That do they, that do they. And about other matters that might better be left to take care of themselves. I have heard them Moravians say that there are lands in which men quarrel even concerning their religion, and if they can get their tempers up on such a subject, hurry, the Lord have mercy on him. Howsoever, there is no occasion for our following their example, and more especially about a husband that this Judith Hutter may never see, or never wish to see. For my part, I feel more curiosity about the feeble-witted sister than about your beauty. There's something that comes close to a man's feelings when he meets with a fellow creature that has all the outward show of an accountable mortal, and who fails of being what he seems, only through a lack of reason. This is bad enough in a man, but when it comes to a woman, and she a young, and maybe a winning creature, it touches all the pitiful thoughts his nature has. God knows, hurry, that such poor things be defenseless enough with all their wits about them, but it's a cruel fortune when that great protector and guide fails them. Hark, Deerslayer, you know what the hunters, and trappers, and peltry men in general be, and their best friends will not deny that they are headstrong and given to having their own way, without much bethinking them of other people's rights or feelings, and yet I don't think the man is to be found, in all this region, who would harm Hetty Hutter, if he could, no, not even a redskin. Therein, friend Hurry, you do the Delawares, at least, and all their allied tribes, only justice, for a redskin looks upon a being thus struck by God's power as especially under his care. I rejoice to hear what you say, however, I rejoice to hear it, but as the sun is beginning to turn towards the afternoon sky, had we not better strike the trail again, and make forward, that we may get an opportunity of seeing these wonderful sisters? Harry March giving a cheerful assent, the remnants of the meal were soon collected, then the travelers shouldered their packs, resumed their arms, and, quitting the little area of light, they again plunged into the deep shadows of the forest. Chapter 2. Thort passing from the lake's green side, and the hunter's hearth away, for the time of flowers, for the summer's pride, daughter. Thou canst not stay. Mrs. Hemans, Edith. A Tale of the Woods 2. 191-94. Our two adventurers had not far to go. Hurry knew the direction, as soon as he had found the open spot in the spring, and he now led on with the confident step of a man assured of his object. The forest was dark, as a matter of course, but it was no longer obstructed by underbrush, and the footing was firm and dry. After proceeding near a mile, March stopped, and began to cast about him with an inquiring look, examining the different objects with care, and occasionally turning his eyes on the trunks of the fallen trees, with which the ground was well sprinkled, as is usually the case in an American wood, especially in those parts of the country where timber has not yet become valuable. "This must be the place, Deerslayer," March at length observed. "Here is a beech by the side of a hemlock, with three pines at hand, and yonder is a white birch with a broken top, and yet I see no rock, nor any of the branches bent down, as I told you would be the case." "Broken branches are unskillful landmarks, as the least experienced know that branches don't often break of themselves," returned the other, "and they also lead to suspicion and discoveries. The Delawares never trust to broken branches, unless it is in friendly times, and on an open trail. As for the beeches, and pines, and hemlocks, why, they are to be seen on all sides of us, not only by twos and threes, but by forties, and fifties, and hundreds. Very true, Deerslayer, but you never calculate on position. Here is a beech and a hemlock.
Yes, and there is another beech and a hemlock, as loving as two brothers, or, for that matter, more loving than some brothers, and yonder are others, for neither a tree is a rarity in these woods. I fear me, hurry, you are better at trapping beaver and shooting bears, than at leading on a blindish sort of a trail.
Ha! There's what you wish to find, ater all.
Now, Deerslayer, this is one of your Delaware pretensions, for hang me if I see anything but these trees, which do seem to start up around us in a most unaccountable and perplexing manner.
Look this away, hurry here, in a line with the black oak, don't you see the crooked sapling that is hooked up in the branches of the base wood, near it?
Now, that sapling was once snow-ridden, and got the bend by its weight, but it never straightened itself, and fastened itself in among the basewood branches in the way you see. The hand of man did that act of kindness for it.
That hand was mine. Exclaimed Hurry, I found the slender young thing bent to the earth, like an unfortunate creature borne down by misfortune, and stuck it up where you see it.
After all, Deerslayer, I must allow, you're getting to have an uncommon good eye for the woods.
Tis improving, Hurry, tis improving, I will acknowledge, but tis only a child's eye, compared to some I know. There's Tominant, now, though a man so old that few remember when he was in his prime, Tominant lets nothing escape his look, which is more like the scent of a hound than the sight of an eye.
Then Uncas, the father of Chingachgook, and the lawful chief of the Mohicans, is another that it is almost hopeless to pass unseen.
I'm improving, I will allow I'm improving, but far from being perfect, as yet.
And who is this Chingachgook, of whom you talk so much, Deerslayer?
Asked Hurry, as he moved off in the direction of the righted sapling, a loping redskin,
at the best, I make no question.
Not so, Hurry, but the best of loping redskins, as you call him. If he had his rights, he would be a great chief, but, as it is, he is only a brave and just-minded Delaware, respected, and even obeyed in some things, 'tis true, but of a fallen race, and belonging to a fallen people.
Ah! Harry March, 'twould warm the heart within you to sit in their lodges of a winter's night, and listen to the traditions of the ancient greatness and power of the Mohicans.
Harkee, friend Nathaniel, said Hurry, stopping short to face his companion, in order that his words might carry greater weight with them, if a man believed all that other people choose to say in their own favor, he might get an oversized opinion of them, and an undersized opinion of himself. These redskins are notable boasters, and I set down more than half of their traditions as pure talk.
There is truth in what you say, Hurry, I'll not deny it, for I've seen it, and believe it.
They do boast, but then that is a gift from nature, and it's sinful to withstand natural gifts.
See, this is the spot you come to find.
This remark cut short the discourse, and both the men now gave all their attention to the object immediately before them.
Deerslayer pointed out to his companion the trunk of a huge linden, or basewood, as it is termed in the language of the country, which had filled its time, and fallen by its own weight. This tree, like so many millions of its brethren, lay where it had fallen, and was moldering under the slow but certain influence of the seasons. The decay, however, had attacked its center, even while it stood erect in the pride of vegetation, bellowing out its heart, as disease sometimes destroys the vitals of animal life, even while a fair exterior is presented to the observer. As the trunk lay stretched for near 100 feet along the earth, the quick eye of the hunter detected this peculiarity, and from this and other circumstances, he knew it to be the tree of which March was in search.
"Eh, here we have what we want," cried Hurry, looking in at the larger end of the linden. "Everything is as snug as if it had been left in an old woman's cupboard.
Come, lend me a hand, Deerslayer, and we'll be afloat in half an hour."
At this call the hunter joined his companion, and the two went to work deliberately and regularly, like men accustomed to the sort of thing in which they were employed. In the first place, Hurry removed some pieces of bark that lay before the large opening in the tree, and which the other declared to be disposed in a way that would have been more likely to attract attention than to conceal the cover, had any straggler passed that way. The two then drew out a bark canoe, containing its seats, paddles, and other appliances, even to fishing lines and rods. This vessel was by no means small, but such was its comparative lightness, and so gigantic was the strength of Hurry, that the latter shouldered it with seeming ease, declining all assistance, even in the act of raising it to the awkward position in which he was obliged to hold it.
"Lead ahead, Deerslayer," said March, "and open the bushes, the rest I can do for myself."
The other obeyed, and the men left the spot, Deerslayer clearing the way for his companion, and inclining to the right or to the left, as the latter directed. In about 10 minutes they both broke suddenly into the brilliant light of the sun, on a low gravelly point, that was washed by water on quite half its outline. An exclamation of surprise broke from the lips of Deerslayer, an exclamation that was low and guardedly made, however, for his habits were much more thoughtful and regulated than those of the reckless Hurry, when on reaching the margin of the lake, he beheld a view that unexpectedly met his gaze. It was, in truth, sufficiently striking to merit a brief description. On a level with the point lay a broad sheet of water, so placid and limpid that it resembled a bed of the pure mountain atmosphere, compressed into a setting of hills and woods. Its length was about 3 leagues, while its breadth was irregular, expanding to half a league, or even more, opposite to the point, and contracting to less than half that distance, more to the southward. Of course, its margin was irregular, being indented by bays, and broken by many projecting, low points. At its northern, or nearest end, it was bounded by an isolated mountain, lower land falling off east and west, gracefully relieving the sweep of the outline. Still the character of the country was mountainous, high hills, or low mountains, rising abruptly from the water, on quite 9/10 of its circuit. The exceptions, indeed, only served a little to vary the scene, and even beyond the parts of the shore that were comparatively low, the background was high, though more distant. But the most striking peculiarities of this scene were its solemn solitude and sweet repose. On all sides, wherever the eye turned, nothing met it but the mirror-like surface of the lake, the placid view of heaven, and the dense setting of woods. So rich and fleecy were the outlines of the forest, that scarce an opening could be seen, the whole visible earth, from the rounded mountaintop to the water's edge, presenting one unvaried hue of unbroken verdure. As if vegetation were not satisfied with a triumph so complete, the trees overhung the lake itself, shooting out towards the light, and there were miles along its eastern shore, where a boat might have pulled beneath the branches of dark Rembrandt-looking hemlocks, quivering aspens, and melancholy pines. In a word, the hand of man had never yet defaced or deformed any part of this native scene, which lay bathed in the sunlight, a glorious picture of affluent forest grandeur, softened by the balminess of June, and relieved by the beautiful variety afforded by the presence of so broad an expanse of water. This is grand. 'Tis solemn. 'Tis an education of itself, to look upon, exclaimed Deerslayer, as he stood leaning on his rifle, and gazing to the right and left, north and south, above and beneath, in whichever direction his eye could wander, not a tree disturbed even by redskin hand, as I can discover, but everything left in the ordering of the Lord, to live and die according to his own designs and laws. Hurry, your Judith ought to be a moral and well-disposed young woman, if she is past half the time you mention in the center of a spot so favored. That's naked truth, and yet the gal has the vagaries. All her time has not been passed here, howsoever, old Tom having the custom, afore I knowed him, of going to spend the winters in the neighborhood of the settlers, or under the guns of the forts. No, no, Jude has caught more than is for her good from the settlers, and especially from the galanifying officers. If she has, Hurry, this is a school to set her mind right again. But what is this I see off here, abreast of us, that seems too small for an island, and too large for a boat, though it stands in the midst of the water? Why, that is what these galantine gentry from the forts call Muskrat Castle, and old Tom himself will grin at the name, though it bears so hard on his own nature and character. 'Tis the stationary house, there being two, this, which never moves, and the other, that floats, being sometimes in one part of the lake and sometimes in another. The last goes by the name of the Ark, though what may be the meaning of the word is more than I can tell you. It must come from the missionaries, Hurry, whom I have heard speak and read of such a thing. They say that the earth was once covered with water, and that Noah, with his children, was saved from drowning by building a vessel called an ark, in which he embarked in season. Some of the Delawares believe this tradition, and some deny it, but it behooves you and me, as white men born, to put our faith in its truth. Do you see anything of this ark? 'Tis down south, no doubt, or anchored in some of the bays. But the canoe is ready, and 15 minutes will carry two such paddles as yourn and mine to the castle. At this suggestion, Deerslayer helped his companion to place the different articles in the canoe, which was already afloat. This was no sooner done than the two frontiermen embarked, and by a vigorous push sent the light bark some 8 or 10 rods from the shore. Hurry now took the seat in the stern, while Deerslayer placed himself forward, and by leisurely but steady strokes of the paddles, the canoe glided across the placid sheet, towards the extraordinary-looking structure that the former had styled Muskrat Castle. Several times the men ceased paddling, and looked about them at the scene, as new glimpses opened from behind points, enabling them to see farther down the lake, or to get broader views of the wooded mountains. The only changes, however, were in the new forms of the hills, the varying curvature of the bays, and the wider reaches of the valley south, the whole earth apparently being clothed in a gale dress of leaves. "This is a sight to warm the heart," exclaimed Deerslayer, when they had thus stopped for the fourth or fifth time. "The lake seems made to let us get an insight into the noble forests, and land and water alike stand in the beauty of God's providence. Do you say, Hurry, that there is no man who calls himself lawful owner of all these glories?"
"None but the king, lad. He may pretend to some right of that nature, but he is so far away that his claim will never trouble old Tom Hutter, who has got possession, and is like to keep it as long as his life lasts. Tom is no squatter, not being on land, I call him a floater. I envy that man. I know it's wrong, and I strive again the feeling, but I envy that man. Don't think, Hurry, that I'm consorting any plan to put myself in his moccasins, for such a thought doesn't harbor in my mind, but I can't help a little envy. 'Tis a natural feeling, and the best of us are but natural, after all, and give way to such feelings at times."
"You've only to marry Hetty to inherit half the estate," cried Hurry, laughing. "The gal is comely. Nay, if it wasn't for her sister's beauty she would be even handsome, and then her wits are so small that you may easily convert her into one of your own way of thinking, in all things. Do you take Hetty off the old fellow's hands, and I'll engage he'll give you an interest in every deer you can knock over within 5 miles of his lake."
"Does game abound?" suddenly demanded the other, who paid but little attention to March's raillery.
"It has the country to itself. Scarce a trigger is pulled on it, and as for the trappers, this is not a region they greatly frequent. I ought not to be so much here myself, but Jude pulls one way, while the beaver pulls another. More than $100 Spanish has that creature cost me the last 2 seasons, and yet I could not forego the wish to look upon her face once more."
"Do the redmen often visit this lake, Hurry?" continued Deerslayer, pursuing his own train of thought.
"Why, they come and go, sometimes in parties, and sometimes singly. The country seems to belong to no native tribe in particular, and so it has fallen into the hands of the Hutter tribe. The old man tells me that some sharp ones have been wheedling the Mohawks for an Indian deed, in order to get a title out of the colony, but nothing has come of it, seeing that no one heavy enough for such a trade has yet meddled with the matter. The hunters have a good life lease still in this wilderness."
"So much the better, so much the better, Hurry. If I was King of England, the man that felled one of these trees without good occasion for the timber, should be banished to a deserted and forlorn region, in which no four-footed animal ever trod. Right glad am I that Chingachgook appointed our meeting on this lake, for hitherto eye of mine never looked on such a glorious spectacle."
"That's because you've kept so much among the Delawares, in whose country there are no lakes. Now, farther north and farther west these bits of water abound, and you're young, and may yet live to see 'em. But though there be other lakes, Deerslayer, there's no other Judith Hutter."
At this remark his companion smiled, and then he dropped his paddle into the water, as if in consideration of a lover's haste. Both now pulled vigorously until they got within 100 yards of the castle, as Hurry familiarly called the house of Hutter, when they again ceased paddling, the admirer of Judith restraining his impatience the more readily, as he perceived that the building was untenanted, at the moment. This new pause was to enable Deerslayer to survey the singular edifice, which was of a construction so novel as to merit a particular description. Muskrat Castle, as the house had been facetiously named by some waggish officer, stood in the open lake, at a distance of fully 1/4 mile from the nearest shore. On every other side the water extended much farther, the precise position being distant about 2 miles from the northern end of the sheet, and near, if not quite, 1 mile from its eastern shore. As there was not the smallest appearance of any island, but the house stood on piles, with the water flowing beneath it, and Deerslayer had already discovered that the lake was of a great depth, he was fain to ask an explanation of this singular circumstance. Hurry solved the difficulty by telling him that on this spot alone, a long, narrow shoal, which extended for a few hundred yards in a north and south direction, rose within 6 or 8 feet of the surface of the lake, and that Hutter had driven piles into it, and placed his habitation on them, for the purpose of security. The old fellow was burnt out 3 times, atween the Indians and the hunters, and in one affray with the Redskins he lost his only son, since which time he has taken to the water for safety. No one can attack him here, without coming in a boat, and the plunder and scalps would scarce be worth the trouble of digging out canoes. Then it's by no means certain which would whip in such a scrimmage, for old Tom is well supplied with arms and ammunition, and the castle, as you may see, is a tight breastwork again light shot. Deerslayer had some theoretical knowledge of frontier warfare,
though he had never yet been called on to raise his hand in anger against a fellow creature. He saw that Hurry did not overrate the strength of this position in a military point of view, since it would not be easy to attack it without exposing the assailants to the fire of the besieged. A good deal of art had also been manifested in the disposition of the timber of which the building was constructed and which afforded a protection much greater than was usual to the ordinary log cabins of the frontier. The sides and ends were composed of the trunks of large pines, cut about 9 feet long, and placed upright, instead of being laid horizontally, as was the practice of the country. These logs were squared on 3 sides, and had large tenons on each end. Massive sills were secured on the heads of the piles, with suitable grooves dug out of their upper surfaces, which had been squared for the purpose, and the lower tenons of the upright pieces were placed in these grooves, giving them secure fastening below. Plates had been laid on the upper ends of the upright logs, and were kept in their places by a similar contrivance, the several corners of the structure being well fastened by scarfing and pinning the sills and plates. The doors were made of smaller logs, similarly squared, and the roof was composed of light poles, firmly united, and well covered with bark. The effect of this ingenious arrangement was to give its owner a house that could be approached only by water, the sides of which were composed of logs closely wedged together, which were 2 feet thick in their thinnest parts, and which could be separated only by a deliberate and laborious use of human hands, or by the slow operation of time. The outer surface of the building was rude and uneven, the logs being of unequal sizes, but the squared surfaces within gave both the sides and door as uniform an appearance as was desired, either for use or show. The chimney was not the least singular portion of the castle, as Hurry made his companion observe, while he explained the process by which it had been made. The material was a stiff clay, properly worked, which had been put together in a mold of sticks, and suffered to harden, a foot or two at a time, commencing at the bottom. When the entire chimney had thus been raised, and had been properly bound in with outward props, a brisk fire was kindled, and kept going until it was burned to something like a brick red. This had not been an easy operation, nor had it succeeded entirely, but by dint of filling the cracks with fresh clay, a safe fireplace and chimney had been obtained in the end. This part of the work stood on the log door, secured beneath by an extra pile. There were a few other peculiarities about this dwelling, which will better appear in the course of the narrative. "Old Tom is full of contrivances," added Hurry, and he set his heart on the success of his chimney, which threatened more than once to give out altogether, but perseverance will even overcome smoke, and now he has a comfortable cabin of it, though it did promise, at one time, to be a chinky sort of a flue to carry flames and fire. "You seem to know the whole history of the castle, Hurry, chimney and sides," said Deerslayer, smiling. "Is love so overcoming that it causes a man to study the story of his sweetheart's habitation?"
"Partly that, lad, and partly eyesight," returned the good-natured giant, laughing. "There was a large gang of us in the lake, the summer the old fellow built, and we helped him along with the job. I raised no small part of the weight of them uprights with my own shoulders, and the axes flew, I can inform you, Master Natty, while we were being it among the trees ashore. The old devil is no way stingy about food, and as we had often eaten his hearth, we thought we would just house him comfortably, afore we went to Albany with our skins. Yes, many is the meal I've swallowed in Tom Hutter's cabins, and Hetty, though so weak in the way of wits, has a wonderful particular way about a frying pan or a gridiron." While the parties were thus discoursing, the canoe had been gradually drawing nearer to the castle, and was now so close as to require but a single stroke of a paddle to reach the landing. This was at a floored platform in front of the entrance, that might have been some 20 feet square. "Old Tom calls this sort of a wharf his dooryard," observed Hurry, as he fastened the canoe, after he and his companion had left it, "and the gallants from the forts have named it the castle court, though what a court can have to do here is more than I can tell you, seeing that there is no law. 'Tis as I supposed, not a soul within, but the whole family is off on a v'y.g.e. of discovery." While Hurry was bustling about the dooryard, examining the fishing spears, rods, nets, and other similar appliances of a frontier cabin, Deerslayer, whose manner was altogether more rebuked and quiet, entered the building with a curiosity that was not usually exhibited by one so long trained in Indian habits. The interior of the castle was as faultlessly neat as its exterior was novel. The entire space, some 20 feet by 40, was subdivided into several small sleeping rooms, the apartment into which he first entered, serving equally for the ordinary uses of its inmates, and for a kitchen. The furniture was of the strange mixture that it is not uncommon to find in the remotely situated log tenements of the interior. Most of it was rude, and to the last degree rustic, but there was a clock, with a handsome case of dark wood, in a corner, and 2 or 3 chairs,
with a table and bureau, that had evidently come from some dwelling of more than usual pretension. The clock was industriously ticking, but its leaden-looking hands did no discredit to their dull aspect, for they pointed to the hour of 11, though the sun plainly showed it was some time past the turn of the day. There was also a dark, massive chest. The kitchen utensils were of the simplest kind, and far from numerous, but every article was in its place, and showed the nicest care in its condition. After Deerslayer had cast a look about him in the outer room, he raised a wooden latch, and entered a narrow passage that divided the inner end of the house into two equal parts. Frontier usages being no way scrupulous, and his curiosity being strongly excited, the young man now opened a door, and found himself in a bedroom. A single glance sufficed to show that the apartment belonged to females. The bed was of the feathers of wild geese, and filled nearly to overflowing, but it lay in a rude bunk, raised only a foot from the door. On one side of it were arranged, on pegs, various dresses, of a quality much superior to what one would expect to meet in such a place, with ribbons and other similar articles to correspond. Pretty shoes, with handsome silver buckles, such as were then worn by females in easy circumstances, were not wanting, and no less than six fans, of gay colors, were placed half open, in a way to catch the eye by their conceits and hues. Even the pillow, on this side of the bed, was covered with finer linen than its companion, and it was ornamented with a small ruffle. A cap, coquettishly decorated with ribbons, hung above it, and a pair of long gloves, such as were rarely used in those days by persons of the laboring classes, were pinned ostentatiously to it, as if with an intention to exhibit them there, if they could not be shown on the owner's arms. All this Deerslayer saw, and noted with a degree of minuteness that would have done credit to the habitual observation of his friends, the Delawares. Nor did he fail to perceive the distinction that existed between the appearances on the different sides of the bed, the head of which stood against the wall. On that opposite to the one just described, everything was homely and uninviting, except through its perfect neatness. The few garments that were hanging from the pegs were of the coarsest materials and of the commonest forms, while nothing seemed made for show. Of ribbons there was not one, nor was there either cap or kerchief beyond those which Hutter's daughters might be fairly entitled to wear. It was now several years since Deerslayer had been in a spot especially devoted to the uses of females of his own color and race. The sight brought back to his mind a rush of childish recollections, and he lingered in the room with a tenderness of feeling to which he had long been a stranger. He bethought him of his mother, whose homely vestments he remembered to have seen hanging on pegs like those which he felt must belong to Hetty Hutter, and he bethought himself of a sister, whose incipient and native taste for finery had exhibited itself somewhat in the manner of that of Judith, though necessarily in a less degree. These little resemblances opened a long hidden vein of sensations, and as he quitted the room, it was with a saddened mien. He looked no further, but returned slowly and thoughtfully towards the dooryard. "If old Tom has taken to a new calling, and has been trying his hand at the traps," cried Hurry, who had been coolly examining the borderer's implements, "if that is his humor, and you're disposed to remain in these parts, we can make an uncommon comfortable season of it, for, while the old man and I acknowledge the beaver, you can fish, and knock down the deer, to keep body and soul together. I've always give the poorest hunters half a share, but one as active and sartain as yourself might expect a full one. Thank'ee, Hurry, thank'ee, with all my heart, but I do a little beavering for myself as occasions offer. 'Tis true, the Delawares call me Deerslayer, but it's not so much because I'm pretty fatal with the venison as because that while I kill so many bucks and does, I've never yet taken the life of a fellow creature. They say their traditions do not tell of another who had shed so much blood of animals that had not shed the blood of man. I hope they don't account you chicken-hearted, lad. A faint-hearted man is like a no-tailed beaver. I don't believe, Hurry, that they account me as out of the way timorsome, even though they may not account me as out of the way brave. But I'm not quarrelsome, and that goes a great way towards keeping blood off the hands, among the hunters and redskins, and then, Harry March, it keeps blood off the conscience, too. Well, for my part I account game, a redskin, and a Frenchman as pretty much the same thing, though I'm as unquarrelsome a man, too, as there is in all the colonies. I despise a quarreler as I do a cur dog, but one has no need to be over scrupulous when it's the right time to show the flint. I look upon him as the most of a man who acts nearest the right, Hurry. But this is a glorious spot, and my eyes never a weary looking at it. 'Tis your first acquaintance with a lake, and these ideas come over us all at such times. Lakes have a gentle character, as I say, being pretty much water and land, and points and bays. As this definition by no means met the feelings that were uppermost in the mind of the young hunter, he made no immediate answer, but stood gazing at the dark hills and the glassy water in silent enjoyment. "Have the governors or the king's people given this lake a name?" he suddenly asked, as if struck with a new idea. "If they've not begun to blaze their trees, and set up their compasses, and line off their maps, it's likely they've not bethought them to disturb nature with a name. They've not got to that, yet, and the last time I went in with Skins, one of the king's surveyors was questioning me concerning all the region hereabouts. He had heard that there was a lake in this quarter, and had got some general notions about it, such as that there was water and hills, but how much of either, he knowed no more than you know of the Mohawk tongue. I didn't open the trap any wider than was necessary, giving him but poor encouragement in the way of farms and clearings. In short, I left on his mind some such opinion of this country, as a man gets of a spring of dirty water, with a path to it that is so muddy that one mars afore he sets out. He told me they hadn't got the spot down yet on their maps, though I conclude that is a mistake, for he showed me his parchment, and there is a lake down on it, where there is no lake in fact, and which is about 50 miles from the place where it ought to be, if they meant it for this. I don't think my account will encourage him to mark down another, by way of improvement." Here Hurry laughed heartily, such tricks being particularly grateful to a set of men who dreaded the approaches of civilization as a curtailment of their own lawless empire. The egregious errors that existed in the maps of the day, all of which were made in Europe, were, moreover, a standing topic of ridicule among them, for, if they had not science enough to make any better themselves, they had sufficient local information to detect the gross blunders contained in those that existed. Anyone who will take the trouble to compare these unanswerable evidences of the topographical skill of our fathers a century since, with the more accurate sketches of our own time, will at once perceive that the men of the woods had a sufficient justification for all their criticism on this branch of the skill of the colonial governments, which did not at all hesitate to place a river or a lake a degree or two out of the way, even though they lay within a day's march of the inhabited parts of the country. "I'm glad it has no name," resumed Deerslayer, "or at least, no pale-face name, for their christenings always foretell waste and destruction. No doubt, howsoever, the redskins have their modes of knowing it, and the hunters and trappers, too, they are likely to call the place by something reasonable and resembling. As for the tribes, each has its tongue, and its own way of calling things, and they treat this part of the world just as they treat all others. Among ourselves, we've got to calling the place the Glimmerglass, seeing that its whole basin is so often hinged with pines, cast upward to its face as if it would throw back the hills that hang over it. There is an outlet, I know, for all lakes have outlets, and the rock at which I am to meet Chingachgook stands near an outlet. Has that no colony name yet? In that particular they've got the advantage of us, having one end, and that the biggest, in their own keeping, they've given it a name which has found its way up to its source, names naturally working upstream. No doubt, Deerslayer, you've seen the Susquehanna, down in the Delaware country? That have I, and hunted along its banks 100 times. That and this are the same in fact, and, I suppose, the same in sound. I am glad they've been compelled to keep the Redman's name, for it would be too hard to rob them of both land and name." Deerslayer made no answer, but he stood leaning on his rifle, gazing at the view which so much delighted him. The reader is not to suppose, however, that it was the picturesque alone which so strongly attracted his attention. The spot was very lovely, of a truth, and it was then seen in one of its most favorable moments, the surface of the lake being as smooth as glass and as limpid as pure air, throwing back the mountains, clothed in dark pines, along the whole of its eastern boundary, the points thrusting forward their trees even to nearly horizontal lines, while the bays were seen glittering through an occasional arch beneath, left by a vault fretted with branches and leaves. It was the air of deep repose the solitudes, that spoke of scenes and forests untouched by the hands of Monterey of nature, in a word, that gave so much pure delight to one of his habits and turn of mind. Still, he felt, though it was unconsciously, like a poet also. If he found a pleasure in studying this large, and to him unusual opening into the mysteries and forms of the woods, as one is gratified in getting broader views of any subject that has long occupied his thoughts, he was not insensible to the innate loveliness of such a landscape neither, but felt a portion of that soothing of the spirit which is a common attendant of a scene so thoroughly pervaded by the holy cairn of nature. Chapter 3. "Come, shall we go and kill us venison? And yet it irks me, the poor dappled foals, - being native burghers of this desert city, - should, in their own confines, with forked heads have their round haunches gored. As You Like It, 2:21-25. Hurry thought more of the beauties of Judith Hutter than of those of the Glimmerglass and its accompanying scenery. As soon as he had taken a sufficiently intimate survey of Floating Tom's implements, therefore, he summoned his companion to the canoe, that they might go down the lake in quest of the family. Previously to embarking, however, Hurry carefully examined the whole of the northern end of the water with an indifferent ship's glass, that formed a part of Hutter's effects. In this scrutiny, no part of the shore was overlooked, the bays and points in particular being subjected to a closer inquiry than the rest of the wooded boundary.
"'Tis as I thought," said Hurry, laying aside the glass, "the old fellow is drifting about the south in this fine weather, and has left the castle to defend itself. Well, now we know that he is not up this away. 'Twill be but a small matter to paddle down and hunt him up in his hiding place."
"Does Master Hutter think it necessary to burrow on this lake?" inquired Deerslayer, as he followed his companion into the canoe.
"To my eye it is such a solitude as one might open his whole soul in, and fear no one to disarrange his thoughts or his worship.
You forget your friends the Mingos, and all the French savages. Is there a spot on earth, Deerslayer, to which them disquiet rogues don't go? Where is the lake, or even the deer lick, that the blackguards don't find out, and having found out, don't, sooner or later, discolor its water with blood?
I hear no good character of them, certainly, friend Hurry, though I've never been called on, yet, to meet them, or any other mortal, on the warpath. I dare to say that such a lovely spot as this, would not be likely to be overlooked by such plunderers, for, though I've not been in the way of quarreling with them tribes myself, the Delawares give me such an account of them that I've pretty much set them down in my own mind, as thorough miscreants.
You may do that with a safe conscience, or for that matter, any other savage you may happen to meet."
Here Deerslayer protested, and as they went paddling down the lake, a hot discussion was maintained concerning the respective merits of the Pale Faces and the Redskins. Hurry had all the prejudices and antipathies of a white hunter, who generally regards the Indian as a sort of natural competitor, and not unfrequently as a natural enemy. As a matter of course, he was loud, clamorous, dogmatical and not very argumentative. Deerslayer, on the other hand, manifested a very different temper, proving by the moderation of his language, the fairness of his views, and the simplicity of his distinctions, that he possessed every disposition to hear reason, a strong, innate desire to do justice, and an ingenuousness that was singularly indisposed to have recourse to sophism to maintain an argument, or to defend a prejudice. Still he was not altogether free from the influence of the latter feeling. This tyrant of the human mind, which ruses on it prey through a thousand avenues, almost as soon as men begin to think and feel, and which seldom relinquishes its iron sway until they cease to do either, had made some impression on even the just propensities of this individual, who probably offered in these particulars, a fair specimen of what absence from bad example, the want of temptation to go wrong, and native good feeling can render youth.
"You will allow, Deerslayer, that a Mingo is more than half devil," cried Hurry, following up the discussion with an animation that touched closely on ferocity, "though you want to over-persuade me that the Delaware tribe is pretty much made up of angels. Now, I gainsay that proposal, concerning white men, even. All white men are not faultless, and therefore all Indians can't be faultless. And so your argument is out at the elbow in the start. But this is what I call reason. Here's three colors on earth, white, black, and red. White is the highest color, and therefore the best man. Black comes next, and is put to live in the neighborhood of a white man, as tolerable, and fit to be made use of, and red comes last, which shows that those that made him never expected an Indian to be accounted as more than half human.
God made all three alike, Hurry.
Alike. Do you call a nigger like a white man, or me like an Indian? You go off at half cock, and don't hear me out. God made us all, white, black, and red, and, no doubt, had his own wise intentions in coloring us differently. Still, he made us, in the main, much the same in feelings, though I'll not deny that he gave each race its gifts. A white man's gifts are Christianized, while the redskins are more for the wilderness. Thus, it would be a great offense for a white man to scalp the dead, whereas it's a signal virtue in an Indian. Then again, a white man cannot ambush women and children in war, while a redskin may. 'Tis cruel work, I'll allow, but for them it's lawful work, while for us, it would be grievous work.
That depends on your enemy. As for scalping, or even skinning a savage, I look upon them pretty much the same as cutting off the ears of wolves for the bounty, or stripping a bear of its hide. And then you're out significantly, as to taking the pole of a redskin in hand, seeing that the very colony has offered a bounty for the job, all the same as it pays for wolves' ears and crows' heads.
Ay, and a bad business it is, Hurry. Even the Indians themselves cry shame on it, seeing it's again a white man's gifts. I do not pretend that all that white men do, is properly Christianized, and according to the lights given them, for then they would be what they ought to be, which we know they are not, but I will maintain that tradition, and use, and color, and laws, make such a difference in races as to amount to gifts. I do not deny that there are tribes among the Indians that are naturally perverse and wicked, as there are nations among the whites. Now, I account the Mingos as belonging to the first, and the Frenchers, in the Canadas, to the last. In a state of lawful warfare, such as we have lately got into, it is a duty to keep down all compassionate feelings, so far as life goes, again either, but when it comes to scalps, it's a very different matter. Just hearken to reason, if you please, Deerslayer, and tell me if the colony can make an unlawful law? Isn't an unlawful law more against nature than scalp in a savage? A law can no more be unlawful than truth can be a lie. That sounds reasonable, but it has a most unreasonable bearing, Hurry. Laws don't all come from the same quarter. God has given us his sin, and some come from the colony, and others come from the king and parliament. When the colony's laws, or even the king's laws, run again the laws of God, they get to be unlawful, and ought not to be obeyed. I hold to a white man's respecting white laws, so long as they do not cross the track of a law coming from a higher authority, and for a red man to obey his own redskin usages, under the same privilege. But, 'tis useless talking, as each man will think for himself, and have his say agreeable to his thoughts. Let us keep a good lookout for your friend Floating Tom, lest we pass him, as he lies hidden under this bushy shore. Deerslayer had not named the borders of the lake amiss. Along their whole length, the smaller trees overhung the water, with their branches often dipping in the transparent element. The banks were steep, even from the narrow strand, and, as vegetation invariably struggles towards the light, the effect was precisely that at which the lover of the picturesque would have aimed, had the ordering of this glorious setting of forest been submitted to his control. The points and bays, too, were sufficiently numerous to render the outline broken and diversified. As the canoe kept close along the western side of the lake, with a view, as Hurry had explained to his companion, of reconnoitering for enemies, before he trusted himself too openly in sight, the expectations of the two adventurers were kept constantly on the stretch, as neither could foretell what the next turning of a point might reveal. Their progress was swift, the gigantic strength of Hurry enabling him to play with the light bark as if it had been a feather, while the skill of his companion almost equalized their usefulness, notwithstanding the disparity in natural means. Each time the canoe passed a point, Hurry turned a look behind him, expecting to see the ark anchored, or beached in the bay. He was fated to be disappointed, however, and they had got within a mile of the southern end of the lake, or a distance of quite 2 leagues from the castle, which was now hidden from view by half a dozen intervening projections of the land, when he suddenly ceased paddling, as if uncertain in what direction next to steer. "It is possible that the old chap has dropped into the river," said Hurry, after looking carefully along the whole of the eastern shore, which was about a mile distant, and open to his scrutiny for more than half its length, for he has taken to trapping considerable, of late, and, barring floodwood, he might drop down at a mile or so, though he would have a most scratching time in getting back again. "Where is this outlet?" asked Deerslayer. "I see no opening in the banks or the trees, that looks as if it would let a river like the Susquehanna run through it." "Eh, Deerslayer, rivers are like human mortals, having small beginnings, and ending with broad shoulders and wide mouths. You don't see the outlet, because it passes atween high, steep banks, and the pines, and hemlocks and basswoods hang over it, as a roof hangs over a house. If old Tom is not in the Rat's Cove, he must have burrowed in the river. We'll look for him first in the cove, and then we'll cross to the outlet." As they proceeded, Hurry explained that there was a shallow bay, formed by a long, low point, that had got the name of the Rat's Cove, from the circumstance of its being a favorite haunt of the muskrat, and which offered so complete a cover for the ark, that its owner was fond of lying in it, whenever he found it convenient. "As a man never knows who may be his visitors, in this part of the country," continued Hurry, "it's a great advantage to get a good look at 'em before they come too near. Now it's war, such caution is more than commonly useful, since a Canada man or a Mingo might get into his hut afore he invited him. But Hutter is a first-rate lookouter, and can pretty much scent danger, as a hound scents the deer. I should think the castle so open, that it would be certain to draw enemies, if any happened to find the lake, a thing unlikely enough, I will allow, as it's off the trail of the forts and settlements. Why, Deerslayer, I've got to believe that a man meets with enemies easier than he meets with friends. It's scareful to think for how many causes one gets to be your enemy, and for how few your friend. Some take up the hatchet because you don't think just as they think, others some because you run ahead of them in the same day, and I once knowed a vagabond that quarreled with a friend because he didn't think him handsome. Now, you're no monument in the way of beauty, yourself, Deerslayer, and yet you wouldn't be so unreasonable as to become my enemy for just saying so. I'm as the Lord made me, and I wish to be accounted no better, nor any worse. Good looks I may not have, that is to say, to a degree that the light-minded and vain crave, but I hope I'm not altogether without some recommend in the way of good conduct. There's few nobler looking men to be seen than yourself, Hurry, and I know that I am not to expect any to turn their eyes on me, when such a one as you can be gazed on, but I do not know that a hunter is less expert with the rifle, or less to be relied on for food, because he doesn't wish to stop at every shining spring he may meet, to study his own countenance in the water. Here Hurry burst into a fit of loud laughter, for while he was too reckless to care much about his own manifest physical superiority, he was well aware of it, and, like most men who derive an advantage from the accidents of birth or nature, he was apt to think complacently on the subject, whenever it happened to cross his mind. No, no, Deerslayer, you're no beauty, as you'll own yourself, if you look over the side of the canoe, he cried, Jude will say that to your face, if you start her, for a Tartar tongue isn't to be found in any gal's head, in or out of the settlements, if you provoke her to use it. My advice to you is, never to aggravate Judith, though you may tell anything to Hetty, and she'll take it as meek as a lamb. No, Jude will be just as like as not to tell you her opinion concerning your looks. And if she does, Hurry, she will tell me no more than you have said already. You're not thickening up about a small remark, I hope, Deerslayer, when no harm is meant. You are not a beauty, as you must know, and why shouldn't friends tell each other these little trifles? If you was handsome, or ever like to be, I'd be one of the first to tell you of it, and that ought to content you. Now, if Jude was to tell me that I'm as ugly as a sinner, I'd take it as a sort of obligation, and try not to believe her. It's easy for them that nature has favored, to jest about such matters, Hurry, though it is sometimes hard for others. I'll not deny but I've had my cravings towards good looks, yes, I have, but then I've always been able to get them down by considering how many I've known with fair outsides, who have had nothing to boast of inwardly. I'll not deny, Hurry, that I often wish I'd been created more comely to the eye, and more like such a one as yourself in them particulars, but then I get the feeling under by remembering how much better off I am, in a great many respects, than some fellow mortals. I might have been born lame, and unfit even for a squirrel hunt, or blind, which would have made me a burden on myself as well as on my friends, or without hearing, which would have totally unqualified me for ever campaigning or scouting, which I look forward to as part of a man's duty in troublesome times. Yes, yes, it's not pleasant, I will allow, to see them that's more comely, and more sought-after, and honored than yourself, but it may all be borne, if a man looks the evil in the face, and don't mistake his gifts and his obligations. Hurry, in the main, was a good-hearted as well as good-natured fellow, and the self-abasement of his companion completely got the better of the passing feeling of personal vanity. He regretted the allusion he had made to the other's appearance, and endeavored to express as much, though it was done in the uncouth manner that belonged to the habits and opinions of the frontier. I meant no harm, Deerslayer, he answered, in a deprecating manner, and hope you'll forget what I've said. If you're not downright handsome, you've a certain look that says, plainer than any words, that all's right within. Then you set no value by looks, and will the sooner forgive any little slight to your appearance. I will not say that Jude will greatly admire you, for that might raise hopes that would only breed disappointment, but there's Hetty, now, would be just as likely to find satisfaction in looking at you, as in looking at any other man. Then you're altogether too grave and considerate-like, to care much about Judith, for, though the gal is uncommon, she is so general in her admiration, that a man need not be exalted because she happens to smile. I sometimes think the hussy loves herself better than she does anything else breathin'. If she did, Hurry, she'd do no more, I'm afeard, than most queens on their thrones, and ladies in the towns, answered Deerslayer, smiling, and turning back towards his companion with every trace of feeling banished from his honest-looking and frank countenance. I never yet knowed even a Delaware of whom you might not say that much. But here is the end of the long pint you mentioned, and the Rat's Cove can't be far off. This point, instead of thrusting itself forward, like all the others, ran in a line with the main shore of the lake, which here swept within it, in a deep and retired bay, circling round south again, at the distance of a quarter of a mile, and crossed the valley, forming the southern termination of the water. In this bay Hurry felt almost certain of finding the ark, since, anchored behind the trees that covered the narrow strip of the point, it might have lain concealed from prying eyes an entire summer. So complete, indeed, was the cover, In this spot, that our boat hauled close to the beach, within the point, and near the bottom of the bay, could by any possibility be seen from only one direction, and that was from a densely wooded shore within the sweep of the water, where strangers would be little apt to go.
"We shall soon see the ark," said Hurry, as the canoe glided round the extremity of the point, where the water was so deep as actually to appear black. "He loves to burrow up among the rushes, and we shall be in his nest in 5 minutes, although the old fellow may be off among the traps himself."
March proved a false prophet. The canoe completely doubled the point, so as to enable the two travelers to command a view of the whole Cover Bay, for it was more properly the last, and no object, but those that nature had placed there, became visible. The placid water swept round in a graceful curve, the rushes bent gently towards its surface, and the trees overhung it as usual, but all lay in the soothing and sublime solitude of a wilderness. The scene was such as a poet or an artist would have delighted in, but it had no charm for Hurry Harry, who was burning with impatience to get a sight of his light-minded beauty. The motion of the canoe had been attended with little or no noise, the frontiermen habitually getting accustomed to caution in most of their movements, and it now lay on the glassy water appearing to float in air, partaking of the breathing stillness that seemed to pervade the entire scene. At this instant a dry stick was heard cracking on the narrow strip of land that concealed the bay from the open lake. Both the adventurers started, and each extended a hand towards his rifle, the weapon never being out of reach of the arm. "'Twas too heavy for any light creature," whispered Hurry, and it sounded like the tread of a man.
"Not so, not so," returned Deerslayer, "'twas, as you say, too heavy for one, but it was too light for the other. Put your paddle in the water, and send the canoe in, to that log, I'll land and cut off the creature's retreat up the pine, be it a mingo, or be it a muskrat." As Hurry complied, Deerslayer was soon on the shore, advancing into the thicket with a moccasined foot, and a caution that prevented the least noise. In a minute he was in the center of the narrow strip of land, and moving slowly down towards its end, the bushes rendering extreme watchfulness necessary. Just as he reached the center of the thicket the dried twigs cracked again, and the noise was repeated at short intervals, as if some creature having life walked slowly towards the point. Hurry heard these sounds also, and pushing the canoe off into the bay, he seized his rifle to watch the result. A breathless minute succeeded, after which a noble buck walked out of the thicket, proceeded with a stately step to the sandy extremity of the point, and began to slake his thirst from the water of the lake. Hurry hesitated an instant, then raising his rifle hastily to his shoulder, he took sight and fired. The effect of this sudden interruption of the solemn stillness of such a scene was not its least striking peculiarity. The report of the weapon had the usual sharp, short sound of the rifle, but when a few moments of silence had succeeded the sudden crack, during which the noise was floating in air across the water, it reached the rocks of the opposite mountain, where the vibrations accumulated, and were rolled from cavity to cavity for miles along the hills, seeming to awaken the sleeping thunders of the woods. The buck merely shook his head at the report of the rifle and the whistling of the bullet, for never before had he come in contact with man, but the echoes of the hills awakened his distrust, and leaping forward, with his four legs drawn under his body, he fell at once into deep water, and began to swim towards the foot of the lake. Hurry shouted and dashed forward in chase, and for 1 or 2 minutes the water foamed around the pursuer and the pursued. The former was dashing past the point, when Deerslayer appeared on the sand and signed to him to return. "'Twas inconsiderate to pull a trigger, afore we had reconnoitred the shore, and made certain that no enemies harbored near it," said the latter, as his companion slowly and reluctantly complied. "This much I have learned from the Delawares, in the way of schooling and traditions, even though I've never yet been on a warpath. And, moreover, venison can hardly be called in season now, and we do not want for food. They call me Deerslayer, I alone, and perhaps I deserve the name, in the way of understanding the creature's habits, as well as for some certainty in the aim, but they can't accuse me of killing an animal when there is no occasion for the meat, or the skin. I may be a slayer, it's true, but I'm no slaughterer." "'Twas an awful mistake to miss that buck," exclaimed Hurry, doffing his cap and running his fingers through his handsome but matted curls, as if he would loosen his tangled ideas by the process. "I've not done so unhandy a thing since I was 15. Never lament it, as the creature's death could have done neither of us any good, and might have done us harm. Them echoes are more awful in my ears than your mistake, Hurry, for they sound like the voice of nature calling out again a wasteful and one-thinking action. You'll hear plenty of such calls, if you tarry long in this quarter of the world, lad," returned the other laughing. "The echoes repeat pretty much all that is said or done on the Glimmerglass, in this calm summer weather. If a paddle falls you hear of it sometimes, again and again, as if the hills were mocking your clumsiness, and a laugh, or a whistle,
comes out of them pines, when they're in the humor to speak, in a way to make you believe they can rally converse. So much the more reason for being prudent and silent. I do not think the enemy can have found their way into these hills yet, for I don't know what they are to gain by it, but all the Delawares tell me that, as courage is a warrior's first virtue, so is prudence his second. One such call from the mountains is enough to let a whole tribe into the secret of our arrival. If it does no other good, it will warn old Tom to put the pot over, and let him know visitors are at hand. Come, lad, get into the canoe, and we will hunt the ark up, while there is yet day. Deerslayer complied, and the canoe left the spot. Its head was turned diagonally across the lake, pointing towards the southeastern curvature of the sheet. In that direction, the distance to the shore, or to the termination of the lake, on the course the two were now steering, was not quite a mile, and, their progress being always swift, it was fast lessening under the skillful, but easy sweeps of the paddles. When about halfway across, a slight noise drew the eyes of the men towards the nearest land, and they saw that the buck was just emerging from the lake and wading towards the beach. In a minute, the noble animal shook the water from his flanks, gazed upward at the covering of trees, and, bounding against the bank, plunged into the forest. "That creature goes off with gratitude in his heart," said Deerslayer, "for nature tells him he has escaped a great danger. You ought to have some of the same feelings, Hurry, to think your eye wasn't true, or that your hand was unsteady, when no good could come of a shot that was intended unmeaningly rather than in reason." "I deny the eye and the hand," cried March with some heat. "You've got a little character, down among the Delawares, there, for quickness and certainty, at a deer, but I should like to see you behind one of them pines, and a full-painted Mingo behind another, each with a cocked rifle and a striving for the chance. Them's the situations, Nathaniel, to try the sight and the hand, for they begin with trying the nerves. I never look upon killing a creature as an exploit, but killing a savage is. The time will come to try your hand, now we've got to blows again, and we shall soon know what events and reputation can do in the field. I deny that either hand or eye was unsteady, it was all a miscalculation of the buck, which stood still when he ought to have kept in motion, and so I shot ahead of him. Have it your own way, Hurry, all I contend for is, that it's lucky. I dare say I shall not pull upon a human mortal as steadily or with as light a heart, as I pull upon a deer." "Who's talking of mortals, or of human beings at all, Deerslayer? I put the matter to you on the supposition of an Injun. I dare say any man would have his feelings when it got to be life or death, agin another human mortal, but there would be no such scruples in regard to an Injun, nothing but the chance of his hitting you, or the chance of your hitting him. I look upon the red men to be quite as human as we are ourselves, Hurry. They have their gifts, and their religion, it's true, but that makes no difference in the end, when each will be judged according to his deeds, and not according to his skin. That's downright missionary, and will find little favor up in this part of the country, where the Moravians don't congregate. Now, skin makes the man. This is reason, else how are people to judge of each other? The skin is put on, over all, in order when a creature, or a mortal, is fairly seen, you may know at once what to make of him. You know a bear from a hog, by his skin, and a gray squirrel from a black." "True, Hurry," said the other, looking back and smiling, "nevertheless, they are both squirrels." "Who denies it? But you'll not say that a red man and a white man are both Injuns?" "But I do say they are both men. Men of different races and colors, and having different gifts and traditions, but, in the main, with the same nature. Both have souls, and both will be held accountable for their deeds in this life." Hurry was one of those theorists who believed in the inferiority of all the human race who are not white. His notions on the subject were not very clear, nor were his definitions at all well settled, but his opinions were nonetheless dogmatical or fierce. His conscience accused him of sundry lawless acts against the Indians, and he had found it an exceedingly easy mode of quieting it, by putting the whole family of Redmen, incontinently, without the category of human rights. Nothing angered him sooner than to deny his proposition, more especially if the denial were accompanied by a show of plausible argument, and he did not listen to his companion's remarks with much composure of either manner or feeling. "You're a boy, Deerslayer, misled and misconsated by Delaware arts, and missionary ignorance," he exclaimed, with his usual indifference to the forms of speech, when excited. "You may account yourself as a redskin's brother, but I hold them all to be animals, with nothing human about them but cunning. That they have, I'll allow, but so has a fox, or even a bear. I'm older than you, and have lived longer in the woods or, for that matter, have lived always there, and am not to be told what an Injun is or what he is not. If you wish to be considered a savage, you've only to say so, and I'll name you as such to Judith and the old man, and then we'll see how you'll like your welcome." Here Hurry's imagination did his temper some service, since, by conjuring up the reception his semi-aquatic acquaintance would be likely to bestow on one thus introduced, he burst into a hearty fit of laughter. Deerslayer too well knew the uselessness of attempting to convince such a being of anything against his prejudices, to feel a desire to undertake the task, and he was not sorry that the approach of the canoe to the southeastern curve of the lake gave a new direction to his ideas. They were now, indeed, quite near the place that March had pointed out for the position of the outlet, and both began to look for it with a curiosity that was increased by the expectation of the arc. It may strike the reader as a little singular, that the place where a stream of any size passed through banks that had an elevation of some 20 feet, should be a matter of doubt with men who could not now have been more than 200 yards distant from the precise spot. It will be recollected, however, that the trees and bushes here, as elsewhere, fairly overhung the water, making such a fringe to the lake, as to conceal any little variations from its general outline. "I've not been down at this end of the lake these 2 summers," said Hurry, standing up in the canoe, the better to look about him. There's the rock, showing its chin above the water, and I know that the river begins in its neighborhood." The men now plied the paddles again, and they were presently within a few yards of the rock, floating towards it, though their efforts were suspended. This rock was not large, being merely some 5 or 6 feet high, only half of which elevation rose above the lake. The incessant washing of the water for centuries had so rounded its summit, that it resembled a large beehive in shape, its form being more than usually regular and even. Hurry remarked, as they floated slowly past, that this rock was well known to all the Indians in that part of the country, and that they were in the practice of using it as a mark to designate the place of meeting, when separated by their hunts and marches. "And here is the river, Deerslayer," he continued, "though so shut in by trees and bushes as to look more like an inbush than the outlet of such a sheet as the Glimmerglass." Hurry had not badly described the place, which did truly seem to be a stream lying in ambush. The high banks might have been 100 feet asunder, but, on the western side, a small bit of low land extended so far forward as to diminish the breadth of the stream to half that width. As the bushes hung in the water beneath, and pines that had the stature of church steeples rose in tall columns above, all inclining towards the light, until their branches intermingled, the eye, at a little distance, could not easily detect any opening in the shore, to mark the egress of the water. In the forest above, no traces of this outlet were to be seen from the lake, the whole presenting the same connected and seemingly interminable carpet of leaves. As the canoe slowly advanced, sucked in by the current, it entered beneath an arch of trees, through which the light from the heavens struggled by casual openings, faintly relieving the gloom beneath. "This is a natural ambush," half whispered Hurry, as if he felt that the place was devoted to secrecy and watchfulness. "Depend on it, old Tom has burrowed with the ark somewhere in this quarter. We will drop down with the current a short distance, and ferret him out." "This seems no place for a vessel of any size," returned the other. "It appears to me that we shall have hardly room enough for the canoe." Hurry laughed at the suggestion, and, as it soon appeared, with reason, for the fringe of bushes immediately on the shore of the lake was no sooner passed, than the adventurers found themselves in a narrow stream, of a sufficient depth of limpid water, with a strong current, and a canopy of leaves upheld by arches composed of the limbs of hoary trees. Bushes lined the shores, as usual, but they left sufficient space between them to admit the passage of anything that did not exceed 20 feet in width, and to allow of a perspective ahead of 8 or 10 times that distance. Neither of our 2 adventurers used his paddle, except to keep the light bark in the center of the current, but both watched each turning of the stream, of which there were 2 or 3 within the first 100 yards, with jealous vigilance. Turn after turn, however, was passed, and the canoe had dropped down with the current some little distance, when Hurry caught a bush, and arrested its movement so suddenly and silently as to denote some unusual motive for the act. Deerslayer laid his hand on the stock of his rifle as soon as he noted this proceeding, but it was quite as much with a hunter's habit as from any feeling of alarm. "There the old fellow is," whispered Hurry, pointing with a finger, and laughing heartily, though he carefully avoided making a noise, ratting it away, just as I supposed, up to his knees in the mud and water, looking to the traps and the bait. "But for the life of me I can see nothing of the ark, though I'll bet every skin I take this season, Jude isn't trusting her pretty little feet in the neighborhood of that black mud. The gal's more likely to be braiding her hair by the side of some spring, where she can see her own good looks, and collect scornful feelings agin us men." "You overjudge young women, yes, you do, Hurry, who as often bethink them of their failings as they do of their perfections. I dare to say this Judith, now, is no such admirer of herself, and no such scorner of our sex as you seem to think, and that she is quite as likely to be sarving her father in the house, wherever that may be, as he is to be sarving her among the traps. It's a pleasure to hear truth from a man's tongue, if it be only once in a girl's life, cried a pleasant, rich, and yet soft female voice, so near the canoe as to make both the listeners start. As for you, Master Hurry, fair words are so apt to choke you, that I no longer expect to hear them from your mouth, the last you uttered sticking in your throat, and coming near to death. But I'm glad to see you keep better society than formerly, and that they who know how to esteem and treat women are not ashamed to journey in your company. As this was said, a singularly handsome and youthful female face was thrust through an opening in the leaves, within reach of Deerslayer's paddle. Its owner smiled graciously on the young man, and the frown that she cast on Hurry, though simulated and pettish, had the effect to render her beauty more striking, by exhibiting the play of an expressive but capricious countenance, one that seemed to change from the soft to the severe, the mirthful to the reproving, with facility and indifference. A second look explained the nature of the surprise. Unwittingly, the men had dropped alongside of the ark, which had been purposely concealed in bushes cut and arranged for the purpose, and Judith Hutter had merely pushed aside the leaves that lay before a window, in order to show her face, and speak to them. Chapter 4. And that timid fawn starts not with fear, when I steal to her secret bower, and that young May Violet to me is dear, and I visit the silent streamlet near, to look on the lovely flower. Bryant, An Indian Story, 211-15. The Ark, as the floating habitation of the Hutters was generally called, was a very simple contrivance. A large flat, or scow, composed the buoyant part of the vessel, and in its center, occupying the whole of its breadth, and about two-thirds of its length, stood a low fabric, resembling the castle in construction, though made of materials so light as barely to be bulletproof. As the sides of the scow were a little higher than usual, and the interior of the cabin had no more elevation than was necessary for comfort, this unusual addition had neither a very clumsy nor a very obtrusive appearance. It was, in short, little more than a modern canal boat, though more rudely constructed, of greater breadth than common, and bearing about it the signs of the wilderness, in its bark-covered posts and roof. The scow, however, had been put together with some skill, being comparatively light, for its strength, and sufficiently manageable. The cabin was divided into two apartments, one of which served for a parlor, and the sleeping room of the father, and the other was appropriated to the uses of the daughters. A very simple arrangement sufficed for the kitchen, which was in one end of the scow, and removed from the cabin, standing in the open air, the ark being altogether a summer habitation. The end bush, as Hurry in his ignorance of English termed it, is quite as easily explained. In many parts of the lake and river, where the banks were steep and high, the smaller trees and larger bushes, as has been already mentioned, fairly overhung the stream, their branches not unfrequently dipping into the water. In some instances they grew out in nearly horizontal lines, for 30 or 40 feet. The water being uniformly deepest near the shores, where the banks were highest and the nearest to a perpendicular, Hutter had found no difficulty in letting the ark drop under one of these covers, where it had been anchored with a view to conceal its position, security requiring some such precautions, in his view of the case. Once beneath the trees and bushes, a few stones fastened to the ends of the branches had caused them to bend sufficiently to dip into the river, and a few severed bushes, properly disposed, did the rest. The reader has seen that this cover was so complete as to deceive two men accustomed to the woods, and who were actually in search of those it concealed, a circumstance that will be easily understood by those who are familiar with the matted and wild luxuriance of the virgin American forest, more especially in a rich soil. The discovery of the ark produced very different effects on our two adventurers. As soon as the canoe could be got round to the proper opening, Hurry leapt on board, and in a minute was closely engaged in a gay, and a sort of recriminating discourse with Judith, apparently forgetful of the existence of all the rest of the world. Not so with Deerslayer. He entered the ark with a slow, cautious step, examining every arrangement of the cover with curious and scrutinizing eyes. It is true, he cast one admiring glance at Judith, which was extorted by her brilliant and singular beauty, but even this could detain him but a single instant from the indulgence of his interest in Hutter's contrivances. Step by step did he look into the construction of the singular abode, investigate its fastenings and strength, ascertain its means of defense, and make every inquiry that would be likely to occur to one whose thoughts dwelt principally on such expedients. Nor was the cover neglected. Of this he examined the whole minutely, his commendation escaping him more than once in audible comments. Frontier usages admitting of this familiarity, he passed through the rooms, as he had previously done at the castle, and opening a door issued into the end of the scow opposite to that where he had left Hurry and Judith. Here he found the other sister, employed at some coarse needlework, seated beneath the leafy canopy of the cover. As Deerslayer's examination was by this time ended, he dropped the butt of his rifle, and, leaning on the barrel with both hands, he turned towards the girl with an interest the singular beauty of her sister had not awakened. He had gathered from Hurry's remarks that Hetty was considered to have less intellect than ordinarily falls to the share of human beings, and his education among Indians had taught him to treat those who were thus afflicted by Providence with more than common tenderness. Nor was there anything in Hetty Hutter's appearance, as so often happens, to weaken the interest her situation excited. An idiot she could not properly be termed, her mind being just enough enfeebled to lose most of those traits that are connected with the more artful qualities, and to retain its ingenuousness and love of truth. It had often been remarked of this girl, by the few who had seen her, and who possessed sufficient knowledge to discriminate, that her perception of the right seemed almost intuitive, while her aversion to the wrong formed so distinctive a feature of her mind, as to surround her with an atmosphere of pure morality, peculiarities that are not infrequent with persons who are termed feeble-minded, as if God had forbidden the evil spirits to invade a precinct so defenseless, with the benign purpose of extending a direct protection to those who had been left without the usual aids of humanity. Her person, too, was agreeable, having a strong resemblance to that of her sister's, of which it was a subdued and humble copy. If it had none of the brilliancy of Judith's, the calm, quiet, almost holy expression of her meek countenance seldom failed to win on the observer, and few noted it long that did not begin to feel a deep and lasting interest in the girl. She had no color, in common, nor was her simple mind apt to present images that caused her cheek to brighten, though she retained a modesty so innate that it almost raised her to the unsuspecting purity of a being superior to human infirmities. Guileless, innocent, and without distrust, equally by nature and from her mode of life, Providence had, nevertheless, shielded her from harm, by a halo of moral light, as it is said to temper the wind to the shorn lamb. "You are Hetty Hutter," said Deerslayer, in the way one puts a question unconsciously to himself, assuming a kindness of tone and manner that were singularly adapted to win the confidence of her he addressed. "Hurry Harry has told me of you, and I know you must be the child?" "Yes, I'm Hetty Hutter," returned the girl in a low, sweet voice, which nature, aided by some education, had preserved from vulgarity of tone and utterance. "I'm Hetty, Judith Hutter's sister, and Thomas Hutter's youngest daughter." "I know your history, then, for Hurry Harry talks considerable, and he is free of speech when he can find other people's concerns to dwell on. You pass most of your life on the lake, Hetty?"
"Certainly. Mother is dead, father is gone a-trapping, and Judith and I stay at home."
"What's your name?"
"That's a question more easily asked than it is answered, young woman, seeing that I'm so young, and yet have borne more names than some of the greatest chiefs in all America."
"But you've got a name. You don't throw away one name, before you come honestly by another?"
"I hope not, gal, I hope not. My names have come naturally, and I suppose the one I bear now will be of no great lasting, since the Delaware seldom settle on a man's raw title, until such time as he has an opportunity of showing his true nature, in the council, or on the warpath, which has never behappened me, seeing firstly, because I'm not born a redskin and have no right to sit in their counselings, and am much too humble to be called on for opinions from the great of my own color, and, secondly, because this is the first war that has befallen in my time, and no enemy has yet inroaded far enough into the colony to be reached by an arm even longer than mine."
"Tell me your names," added Hetty, looking up at him artlessly, "and, maybe, I'll tell you your character."
"There is some truth in that, I'll not deny, though it often fails. Men are deceived in other men's characters, and frequently give them names they by no means deserve. You can see the truth of this in the Mingo names, which, in their own tongue, signify the same things as the Delaware names, at least, so they tell me, for I know little of the tribe, unless it be by report, and no one can say they are as honest or as upright a nation. I put no great dependence, therefore, on names."
"Tell me all your names," repeated the girl, earnestly, for her mind was too simple to separate things from professions, and she did attach importance to a name. "I want to know what to think of you."
"Well, certain, I've no objection, and you shall hear them all. In the first place, then, I'm Christian, and white-born, like yourself, and my parents had a name that came down from father to son, as is a part of their gifts. My father was called Bumpo, and I was named after him, of course, the given name being Nathaniel, or Natty, as most people saw fit to term it."
"Yes, yes, Natty and Hetty," interrupted the girl quickly, and looking up from her work again, with a smile, "you are Natty, and I'm Hetty, though you are Bumpo, and I'm Hutter. Bumpo isn't as pretty as Hutter, is it?"
"Why, that's as people fancy. Bumpo has no lofty sound,
I admit, and yet men have bumped through the world with it. I did not go by this name, howsoever, very long, for the Delaware soon found out, or thought they found out, that I was not given to lying, and they called me, firstly, Straight Tongue.
That's a good name, interrupted Hetty, earnestly, and in a positive manner, don't tell me there's no virtue in names.
I do not say that, for perhaps I deserve to be so called, lies being no favorites with me, as they are with some. After a while they found out I was quick of foot, and then they called me the Pigeon, which, you know, has a swift wing, and flies in a straight line.
That was a pretty name, exclaimed Hetty. Pigeons are pretty birds.
Most things that God created are pretty in their way, my good gal, though they get to be deformed by mankind, so as to change their natures, as well as their appearance. From carrying messages, and striking blind trails, I got at last to following the hunters, when it was thought I was quicker and surer at finding the game than most lads, and then they called me the Lap-Ear, as, they said, I partook of the sagacity of the hound.
That's not so pretty, answered Hetty, I hope you didn't keep that name long.
Not after I was rich enough to buy a rifle, returned the other, betraying a little pride through his usually quiet and subdued manner, then it was seen I could keep a wigwam in Venson, and in time I got the name of Deerslayer, which is that I now bear, homely as some will think it, who set more value on the scalp of a fellow mortal than on the horns of a buck.
Well, Deerslayer, I'm not one of them, answered Hetty, simply, Judith likes soldiers, and flary coats, and fine feathers, but they're all naught to me. She says the officers are great, and gay, and of soft speech, but they make me shudder, for their business is to kill their fellow creatures. I like your calling better, and your last name is a very good one, better than Natty Bumpo.
This is natural in one of your turn of mind, Hetty, and much as I should have expected. They tell me your sister is handsome on common, for a mortal, and beauty is apt to seek admiration.
Did you never see Judith? Demanded the girl, with quick earnestness, if you never have, go at once and look at her. Even Hurry Harry isn't more pleasant to look at though she is a woman, and he is a man.
Deerslayer regarded the girl for a moment with concern. Her pale face had flushed a little, and her eye, usually so mild and serene, brightened as she spoke, in the way to betray the inward impulses.
Eh, Hurry Harry, he muttered to himself, as he walked through the cabin towards the other end of the boat, this comes of good looks, if a light tongue has had no concern in it. It's easy to see which way that poor creature's feelings are leanin', whatever may be the case with your Judes.
But an interruption was put to the gallantry of Hurry, the coquetry of his intros, the thoughts of Deerslayer, and the gentle feelings of Hetty, by the sudden appearance of the canoe of the Ark's owner, in the narrow opening among the bushes that served as a sort of moat to his position. It would seem that Hutter, or Floating Tom, as he was familiarly called by all the hunters who knew his habits, recognized the canoe of Hurry, for he expressed no surprise at finding him in the scow. On the contrary, his reception was such as to denote not only gratification, but a pleasure, mingled with a little disappointment at his not having made his appearance some days sooner.
I looked for you last week, he said, in a half-grumbling, half-welcoming manner, and was disappointed uncommonly that you didn't arrive. There came a runner through, to warn all the trappers and hunters that the colony and the Canadas were again in trouble, and I felt lonesome, up in these mountains, with three scalps to see to, and only one pair of hands to protect them.
That's reasonable, returned March, and T was feeling like a parent. No doubt, if I had two such starters as Judith and Hetty, my experience would tell the same story, though in general I am just as well satisfied with having the nearest neighbor 50 miles off, as when he is within call.
Notwithstanding, you didn't choose to come into the wilderness alone, now you knew that the Canada savages are likely to be stirring, returned Hutter, giving a sort of distrustful, and at the same time inquiring glance at Deerslayer.
Why should I? They say a bad companion, on a journey, helps to shorten the path, and this young man I account to be a reasonably good one. This is Deerslayer, Old Tom, a noted hunter among the Delawares, and Christian born, and Christian educated, too, like you and me. The lad is not perfect, perhaps, but there's worse men in the country that he came from, and it's likely he'll find some that's no better, in this part of the world. Should we have occasion to defend our traps, and the territory, he'll be useful in feeding us all, for he's a regular dealer in venison.
Young man, you are welcome, growled Tom, thrusting a hard, bony hand towards the youth, as a pledge of his sincerity, in such times, a white face is a friend's, and I count on you as a support. Children sometimes make a stout heart feeble, and these two daughters of mine give me more concern than all my traps, and skins, and rights in the country.
That's natural,
cried Hurry.
Yes, Deerslayer, you and I don't know it yet by experience, but, on the whole, I consider that as natural. If we had darters, it's more than probable we should have some such feelings, and I honor the man that owns them. As for Judith, old man, I enlist, at once, as her soldier, and here is Deerslayer to help you to take care of Hetty.
Many thanks to you, Master March, returned the beauty, in a full, rich voice, and with an accuracy of intonation and utterance that she shared in common with her sister, and which showed that she had been better taught than her father's life and appearance would give reason to expect. Many thanks to you, but Judith Hutter has the spirit and the experience that will make her depend more on herself than on good-looking rovers like you. Should there be need to face the savages, do you land with my father, instead of burrowing in the huts, under the show of defending us females and...
Girl, girl, interrupted the father, quiet that glib tongue of thine, and hear the truth. There are savages on the lake shore already, and no man can say how near to us they may be at this very moment, or when we may hear more from them.
If this be true, Master Hutter, said Hurry, whose change of countenance denoted how serious he deemed the information, though it did not denote any unmanly alarm, if this be true, your ark is in a most misfortunate position, for, though the cover did deceive Deerslayer and myself, it would hardly be overlooked by a full-blooded Injun, who was out seriously in search of scalps. I think as you do, Hurry, and wish, with all my heart, we lay anywhere else, at this moment, than in this narrow, crooked stream, which has many advantages to hide in, but which is almost fatal to them that are discovered. The savages are near us, moreover, and the difficulty is, to get out of the river without being shot down like deer standing at a lick.
Are you certain, Master Hutter, that the redskins you dread are all Canadas? Asked Deerslayer, in a modest but earnest manner. Have you seen any, and can you describe their paint?
I have fallen in with the signs of their being in the neighborhood, but have seen none of them. I was downstream a mile or so, looking to my traps, when I struck a fresh trail, crossing the corner of a swamp, and moving northward. The man had not passed an hour, and I noted for an Indian footstep, by the size of the foot, and the into, even before I found a worn moccasin, which its owner had dropped as useless. For that matter, I found the spot where he halted to make a new one, which was only a few yards from the place where he had dropped the old one.
That doesn't look much like a redskin on the warpath, returned the other, shaking his head. An experienced warrior, at least, would have burned, or buried, or sunk in the river such signs of his passage, and your trail is, quite likely, a peaceable trail. But the moccasin may greatly relieve my mind, if you bethought you of bringing it off. I've come here to meet a young chief myself, and his course would be much in the direction you've mentioned. The trail may have been his'n.
Hurry, Harry, you are well acquainted with this young man, I hope, who has meetings with savages in a part of the country where he has never been before. Demanded Hutter, in a tone and in a manner that sufficiently indicated the motive of the question, these rude beings seldom hesitating, on the score of delicacy, to betray their feelings. Treachery is an Indian virtue, and the whites, that live much in their tribes, soon catch their ways and practices.
True, true is the gospel, old Tom, but not personable to Deerslayer, who's a young man of truth, if he has no other recommend. I'll answer for his honesty, whatever I may do for his valor in battle. I should like to know his errand in this strange quarter of the country.
That is soon told, Master Hutter, said the young man, with the composure of one who kept a clean conscience. I think, moreover, you've a right to ask it. The father of two such darters, who occupies a lake, after your fashion, has just the same right to inquire into a stranger's business in his neighborhood, as the colony would have to demand the reason why the Frenchers put more regiments than common along the lines.
No, no, I'll not deny your right to know why a stranger comes into your habitation or country, in times as serious as these. If such is your way of thinking, friend, let me hear your story without more words.
He is soon told, as I said afore, and shall be honestly told. I'm a young man, and, as yet, have never been on a warpath, but no sooner did the news come among the Delawares, that wampum and a hatchet were about to be sent into the tribe, than they wished me to go out among the people of my own color, and get the exact state of things from. This I did, and, after delivering my talk to the chiefs, on my return, I met an officer of the crown on the Schoharie, who had messages to send to some of the friendly tribes that live farther west. This was thought a good occasion for Chingachgook, a young chief who has never struck a foe, and myself, to go on our first warpath in company, and an appointment was made for us, by an old Delaware, to meet at the rock near the foot of this lake. I'll not deny that Chingachgook has another object in view, but it has no concern with any here, and is his secret and not mine,
therefore I'll say no more about it.
'Tis something about a young woman, interrupted Judith hastily, then laughing at her own impetuosity, and even having the grace to color a little, at the manner in which she had betrayed her readiness to impute such a motive. If 'tis neither a war, nor a hunt, it must be love.
Ay, it comes easy for the young and handsome, who hear so much of them feelings, to suppose that they lie at the bottom of most proceedings, but, on that head, I say nothing.
Chingachgook is to meet me at the rock, an hour afore sunset tomorrow evening, after which we shall go our way together, molesting none but the king's enemies, who are lawfully our own. Knowing Hurry of old, who once trapped in our hunting grounds, and falling in with him on the Schoharie, just as he was on the pine of starting for his summer hands, we agreed to journey in company, not so much from fear of the Mingos, as from good fellowship, and, as he says, to shorten a long road.
And you think the trail I saw may have been that of your friend, ahead of his time? Said Hutter.
That's my day, which may be wrong, but which may be right. If I saw the moccasin, howsoever, I could tell, in a minute, whether it is made in the Delaware fashion, or not.
Here it is, then, said the quick-witted Judith, who had already gone to the canoe in quest of it.
Tell us what it says, friend or enemy. You look honest, and I believe all you say, whatever father may think.
That's the way with you, Jude, forever finding out friends, where I distrust foes, grumbled Tom.
But, speak out, young man, and tell us what you think of the moccasin.
That's not Delaware made, returned Deerslayer, examining the worn and rejected covering for the foot with a cautious eye. I'm too young on a warpath to be positive, but I should say that moccasin has a northern look, and comes from beyond the Great Lakes.
If such is the case, we ought not to lie here a minute longer than is necessary, said Hutter, glancing through the leaves of his cover, as if he already distrusted the presence of an enemy on the opposite shore of the narrow and sinuous stream. It wants but an hour or so of night, and to move in the dark will be impossible, without making a noise that would betray us. Did you hear the echo of a piece in the mountains, half an hour since?
Yes, old man, and heard the piece itself, answered Hurry, who now felt the indiscretion of which he had been guilty, for the last was fired from my own shoulder.
I fear that came from the French Indians, still it may put them on the lookout, and be a means of discovering us. You did wrong to fire in wartime, unless there was good occasion.
So I begin to think myself, Uncle Tom, and yet, if a man can't trust himself to let off his rifle in a wilderness that is 1,000 miles square, lest some enemy should hear it, where's the use in carrying one?
Hutter now held a long consultation with his two guests, in which the parties came to a true understanding of their situation. He explained the difficulty that would exist in attempting to get the ark out of so swift and narrow a stream, in the dark, without making a noise that could not fail to attract Indian ears. Any strollers in their vicinity would keep near the river or the lake, but the former had swampy shores in many places, and was both so crooked and so fringed with bushes, that it was quite possible to move by daylight without incurring much danger of being seen. More was to be apprehended, perhaps, from the ear than from the eye, especially as long as they were in the short, straightened, and canopied reaches of the stream.
I never drop down into this cover, which is handy to my traps, and safer than the lake from curious eyes, without providing the means of getting out again, continued this singular being, and that is easier done by a pull than a push. My anchor is now lying above the suction, in the open lake, and here is a line, you see, to haul us up to it. Without some such help, a single pair of hands would make heavy work in forcing a scow like this upstream. I have a sort of a crab, too, that lightens the pull, on occasion. Jude can use the oar astern as well as myself, and when we fear no enemy, to get out of the river gives us but little trouble.
What should we gain, Master Hutter, by changing the position? Asked Deerslayer, with a good deal of earnestness.
This is a safe cover, and a stout defense might be made from the inside of this cabin. I've never found unless in the way of tradition, but it seems to me we might beat off 20 Mingos, with palisades like them afore us.
Eh, you've never fought except in traditions, that's plain enough, young man. Did you ever see as broad a sheet of water as this above us, before you came in upon it with Hurry?
I can't say that I ever did, Deerslayer answered, modestly. Youth is the time to learn, and I'm far from wishing to raise my voice in council, afore it is justified by experience.
Well, then, I'll teach you the disadvantage of fighting in this position, and the advantage of taking to the open lake. Here, you may see, the savages will know where to aim every shot, and it would be too much to hope that some would not find their way through the crevices of the logs. Now, on the other hand, we should have nothing but a forest to aim at. Then we are not safe from fire, here,
the bark of this roof being little better than so much kindling wood. The castle, too, might be entered and ransacked in my absence, and all my possessions overrun and destroyed. Once in the lake, we can be attacked only in boats or on rafts, shall have a fair chance with the enemy and can protect the castle with the ark. Do you understand this reasoning, youngster?
It sounds well, yes, it has a rational sound, and I'll not gainsay it.
Well, old Tom, cried Hurry, if we are to move, the sooner we make a beginning, the sooner we shall know whether we are to have our scalps for nightcaps, or not. As this proposition was self-evident, no one denied its justice. The three men, after a short preliminary explanation, now set about their preparations to move the ark in earnest. The slight fastenings were quickly loosened, and, by hauling on the line, the heavy craft slowly emerged from the cover. It was no sooner free from the encumbrance of the branches, than it swung into the stream, sheering quite close to the western shore, by the force of the current. Not a soul on board heard the rustling of the branches, as the cabin came against the bushes and trees of the western bank, without a feeling of uneasiness, for no one knew at what moment, or in what place, a secret and murderous enemy might unmask himself. Perhaps the gloomy light that still struggled through the impending canopy of leaves, or found its way through the narrow, ribbon-like opening, which seemed to mark, in the air above, the course of the river that flowed beneath, aided in augmenting the appearance of the danger, for it was little more than sufficient to render objects visible, without giving up all their outlines at a glance. Although the sun had not absolutely set, it had withdrawn its direct rays from the valley, and the hues of evening were beginning to gather around objects that stood uncovered, rendering those within the shadows of the wood still more somber and gloomy. No interruption followed the movement, however, and, as the men continued to haul on the line, the ark passed steadily ahead, the great breadth of the scow preventing its sinking into the water, and from offering much resistance to the progress of the swift element beneath its bottom. Hutter, too, had adopted a precaution suggested by experience, which might have done credit to a seaman, and which completely prevented any of the annoyances and obstacles which otherwise would have attended the short turns of the river. As the ark descended, heavy stones, attached to the line, were dropped in the center of the stream, forming local anchors, each of which was kept from dragging by the assistance of those above it, until the uppermost of all was reached, which got its backing from the anchor, or grapnel, that lay well out in the lake. In consequence of this expedient, the ark floated clear of the encumbrances of the shore, against which it would otherwise have been unavoidably hauled at every turn, producing embarrassments that Hutter, single-handed, would have found it very difficult to overcome. Favored by this foresight, and stimulated by the apprehension of discovery, floating Tom and his two athletic companions hauled the ark ahead with quite as much rapidity as comported with the strength of the line. At every turn in the stream, a stone was raised from the bottom, when the direction of the scow changed to one that pointed towards the stone that lay above. In this manner, with the channel buoyed out for him, as a sailor might term it, did Hutter move forward, occasionally urging his friends, in a low and guarded voice, to increase their exertions, and then, as occasions offered, warning them against efforts that might, at particular moments, endanger all by too much zeal. In spite of their long familiarity with the woods, the gloomy character of the shaded river added to the uneasiness that each felt, and when the ark reached the first bend in the Susquehanna, and the eye caught a glimpse of the broader expanse of the lake, all felt a relief that perhaps none would have been willing to confess. Here the last stone was raised from the bottom, and the line led directly towards the grapnel, which, as Hutter had explained, was dropped above the suction of the current.
"Thank God!" ejaculated Hurry, "there is daylight, and we shall soon have a chance of seeing our enemies, if we are to feel them."
"That is more than you or any man can say," growled Hutter. "There is no spot so likely to harbor a party as the shore around the outlet, and the moment we clear these trees and get into open water, will be the most trying time, since it will leave the enemy a cover, while it puts us out of one. Judith, girl, do you and Hetty leave the oar to take care of itself, and go within the cabin, and be mindful not to show your faces at a window, for they who will look at them won't stop to praise their beauty. And now, Hurry, we'll step into this outer room ourselves, and haul through the door, where we shall all be safe, from a surprise, at least. Friend Deerslayer, as the current is lighter, and the line has all the strain on it that is prudent, do you keep moving from window to window, taking care not to let your head be seen, if you set any value on life. No one knows when or where we shall hear from our neighbors."
Deerslayer complied, with the sensation that had nothing in common with fear, but which had all the interest of a perfectly novel and a most exciting situation. For the first time in his life he was in the vicinity of enemies, or had good reason to think so, and that, too, under all the thrilling circumstances of Indian surprises and Indian artifices.
As he took his stand at the window, the ark was just passing through the narrowest part of the stream, a point where the water first entered what was properly termed the river, and where the trees fairly interlocked overhead, causing the current to rush into an arch of verdure, a feature as appropriate and peculiar to the country, perhaps, as that of Switzerland, where the rivers come rushing literally from chambers of ice. The ark was in the act of passing the last curve of this leafy entrance, as Deerslayer, having examined all that could be seen of the eastern bank of the river, crossed the room to look from the opposite window, at the western. His arrival at this aperture was most opportune, for he had no sooner placed his eye at a crack, than a sight met his gaze that might well have alarmed a sentinel so young and inexperienced. A sapling overhung the water, in nearly half a circle, having first grown towards the light, and then been pressed down into this form by the weight of the snows, a circumstance of common occurrence in the American woods. On this no less than six Indians had already appeared, others standing ready to follow them, as they left room, each evidently bent on running out on the trunk, and dropping on the roof of the ark as it passed beneath. This would have been an exploit of no great difficulty, the inclination of the tree admitting of an easy passage, the adjoining branches offering ample support for the hands, and the fall being too trifling to be apprehended. When Deerslayer first saw this party, it was just unmasking itself, by ascending the part of the tree nearest to the earth, or that which was much the most difficult to overcome, and his knowledge of Indian habits told him at once that they were all in their war paint, and belonged to a hostile tribe. "Pull, hurry," he cried, "pull for your life, and as you love Judith Hutter. Pull, man, pull." This call was made to one that the young man knew had the strength of a giant. It was so earnest and solemn, that both Hutter and March felt it was not idly given, and they applied all their force to the line simultaneously, and at a most critical moment. The scow redoubled its motion, and seemed to glide from under the tree as if conscious of the danger that was impending overhead. Perceiving that they were discovered, the Indians uttered the fearful war whoop, and running forward on the tree, leapt desperately towards their fancied prize. There were six on the tree, and each made the effort. All but their leader fell into the river more or less distant from the ark, as they came, sooner or later, to the leaping place. The chief, who had taken the dangerous post in advance, having an earlier opportunity than the others, struck the scow just within the stern. The fall proving so much greater than he had anticipated, he was slightly stunned, and for a moment he remained half-bent and unconscious of his situation. At this instant Judith rushed from the cabin, her beauty heightened by the excitement that produced the bold act, which flushed her cheek to crimson, and, throwing all her strength into the effort, she pushed the intruder over the edge of the scow, headlong into the river. This decided feat was no sooner accomplished than the woman resumed her sway. Judith looked over the stern to ascertain what had become of the man, and the expression of her eyes softened to concern. Next, her cheek crimsoned between shame and surprise at her own temerity, and then she laughed in her own merry and sweet manner. All this occupied less than a minute, when the arm of Deerslayer was thrown around her waist, and she was dragged swiftly within the protection of the cabin. This retreat was not effected too soon. Scarcely were the two in safety, when the forest was filled with yells, and bullets began to patter against the logs. The ark being in swift motion all this while, it was beyond the danger of pursuit by the time these little events had occurred, and the savages, as soon as the first burst of their anger had subsided, ceased firing, with the consciousness that they were expending their ammunition in vain. When the scow came up over her grapnel, Hutter tripped the ladder in a way not to impede the motion, and being now beyond the influence of the current, the vessel continued to drift ahead, until fairly in the open lake, though still near enough to the land to render exposure to a rifle bullet dangerous. Hutter and March got out two small sweeps and, covered by the cabin, they soon urged the ark far enough from the shore to leave no inducement to their enemies to make any further attempt to injure them. Chapter 5. Why, let the struck and deer go weep, the hard ungalled play, for some must watch, while some must sleep, thus runs the world away. Hamlet, 3-271-74. Another consultation took place in the forward part of the scow, at which both Judith and Hetty were present. As no danger could now approach unseen, immediate uneasiness had given place to the concern which attended the conviction that enemies were in considerable force on the shores of the lake, and that they might be sure no practicable means of accomplishing their own destruction would be neglected. As a matter of course, Hutter felt these truths the deepest, his daughters having an habitual reliance on his resources, and knowing too little to appreciate fully all the risks they ran, while his male companions were at liberty to quit him at any moment they saw fit. His first remark showed that he had an eye to the latter circumstance, and might have betrayed, to a keen observer, the apprehension that was just then uppermost. "We've a great advantage over the Iroquois, or the enemy, whoever they are, in being afloat,"
he said. There's not a canoe on the lake that I don't know where it's hid, and now yours is here.
Hurry, there are but three more on the land, and they're so snug in hollow logs that I don't believe the Indians could find them, let them try ever so long.
There's no telling that no one can say that, put in Deerslayer, a hound is not more certain on the scent than a redskin, when he expects to get anything by it. Let this party see scalps afore 'em, or plunder, or honor according to their idea of what honor is, and 't will be a tight log that hides a canoe from their eyes.
You're right, Deerslayer, cried Harry March, you're downright gospel in this matter, and I read just that my bunch of bark is safe enough here, within reach of my arm. I calculate they'll be at all the rest of the canoes afore tomorrow night, if they're in raw larness to smoke you out, old Tom, and we may as well overhaul our paddles for a pull.
Hutter made no immediate reply. He looked about him in silence for quite a minute, examining the sky, the lake, and the belt of forest which enclosed it, as it might be hermetically, like one consulting their signs. Nor did he find any alarming symptoms. The boundless woods were sleeping in the deep repose of nature, the heavens were placid, but still luminous with the light of the retreating sun, while the lake looked more lovely and calm than it had before done the day. It was a scene altogether soothing, and of a character to lull the passions into a species of holy calm. How far this effect was produced, however, on the party in the ark, must appear in the progress of our narrative.
Judith, called out the father, when he had taken this close but short survey of the omens, night is at hand, find our friends food, a long march gives a sharp appetite.
We're not starving, Master Hutter, March observed, for we filled up just as we reached the lake, and for one, I prefer the company of Judith even to her supper. This quiet evening is very agreeable to sit by her side.
Nature is nature, objected Hutter, and must be fed.
Judith, see to the meal, and take your sister to help you. I've a little discourse to hold with you, friends, he continued, as soon as his daughters were out of hearing, and wish the girls away. You see my situation, and I should like to hear your opinions concerning what is best to be done. Three times have I been burned out already, but that was on the shore, and I've considered myself as pretty safe ever since I got the castle built, and the ark afloat. My other accidents, however, happened in peaceable times, being nothing more than such flurries as a man must meet with, in the woods, but this matter looks serious, and your ideas would greatly relieve my mind.
It's my notion, old Tom, that you, and your huts, and your traps, and your whole possessions, hereaway, are in desperate jeopardy, returned the matter-of-fact Hurry, who saw no use in concealment. According to my idea of valley, they're altogether not worth half as much today as they was yesterday, nor would I give more for 'em, taking the pay and skins.
Then I've children. Continued the father, making the allusion in a way that it might have puzzled even an indifferent observer to say was intended as a bait, or as an exclamation of paternal concern. Daughters, as you know, Hurry, and good girls too, I may say, though I am their father.
A man may say anything, Master Hutter, particularly when pressed by time and circumstances.
You've daughters, as you say, and one of them hasn't her equal on the frontiers for good looks, whatever she may have for good behavior. As for poor Hetty, she's Hetty Hutter, and that's as much as one can say about the poor thing. Give me Jude, if her conduct was only equal to her looks.
I see, Harry March, I can only count on you as a fair-weather friend, and I suppose that your companion will be of the same way of thinking, returned the other, with a slight show of pride, that was not altogether without dignity.
Well, I must depend on Providence, which will not turn a deaf ear, perhaps, to a father's prayers.
If you've understood Hurry, here, to mean that he intends to desert you, said Deerslayer, with an earnest simplicity that gave double assurance of its truth, I think you do him injustice, as I know you do me, in supposing I would follow him. Was he so untrue-hearted as to leave a family of his own color in such a strait as this?
I've come on this at Dake, Master Hutter, to rend us a friend, and I only wish he was here himself, as I make no doubt he will be at sunset tomorrow, when you'd have another rifle to aid you, an inexperienced one, I'll allow, like my own, but one that has proved true so often again the game, big and little, that I'll answer for its sarvice again mortals.
May I depend on you to stand by me and my daughters, then, Deerslayer? Demanded the old man, with a father's anxiety in his countenance.
That may you, Floating Tom, if that's your name, and as a brother would stand by a sister, a husband his wife, or a suitor his sweetheart. In this strait you may count on me, through all adversities, and I think Hurry does discredit to his nature and wishes, if you can't count on him.
Not he, cried Judith, thrusting her handsome face out of the door, his nature is Hurry, as well as his name, and he'll hurry off, as soon as he thinks his fine figure in danger. Neither old Tom,
nor his gals, will depend much on Master March, now they know him, but you they will rely on, Deerslayer, for your honest face and honest heart tell us that what you promise you will perform." This was said, as much, perhaps, in affected scorn for Hurry, as in sincerity. Still, it was not said without feeling. The fine face of Judith sufficiently proved the latter circumstance, and if the conscious March fancied that he had never seen in it a stronger display of contempt a feeling in which the beauty was apt to indulge than while she was looking at him, it certainly seldom exhibited more of a womanly softness and sensibility, than when her speaking blue eyes were turned on his traveling companion. "Leave us, Judith," Hutter ordered sternly, before either of the young men could reply, "leave us, and do not return until you come with the venison and fish. The girl has been spoilt by the flattery of the officers, who sometimes find their way up here, Master March, and you'll not think any harm of her silly words." "You never said truer syllable, old Tom," retorted Hurry, who smarted under Judith's observations. "The devil-tongued youngsters of the garrison have proved her undoing. I scarce know Jude any longer, and shall soon take to admiring her sister, who is getting to be much more to my fancy." "I'm glad to hear this, Harry, and look upon it as a sign that you're coming to your right senses. Hetty would make a much safer and more rational companion than Jude, and would be much the most likely to listen to your suit, as the officers have, I greatly fear, unsettled her sister's mind." "No man needs a safer wife than Hetty," said Hurry, laughing, "though I'll not answer for her being of the most rational. But no matter, Deerslayer has not misconceived me, when he told you I should be found at my post. I'll not quit you, Uncle Tom, just now, whatever may be my feelings and intentions respecting your eldest daughter." Hurry had a respectable reputation for prowess among his associates, and Hutter heard this pledge with a satisfaction that was not concealed. Even the great personal strength of such an aide became of moment, in moving the ark, as well as in the species of hand-to-hand conflicts, that were not unfrequent in the woods, and no commander who was hard-pressed could feel more joy at hearing of the arrival of reinforcements, than the borderer experienced at being told this important auxiliary was not about to quit him. A minute before, Hutter would have been well content to compromise his danger, by entering into a compact to act only on the defensive, but no sooner did he feel some security on this point, than the restlessness of man induced him to think of the means of carrying the war into the enemy's country. "High prices are offered for scalps on both sides," he observed, with a grim smile, as if he felt the force of the inducement, at the very time he wished to affect a superiority to earning money by means that the ordinary feelings of those who aspire to be civilized men repudiated, even while they were adopted. "It isn't right, perhaps, to take gold for human blood, and yet, when mankind is busy in killing one another, there can be no great harm in adding a little bit of skin to the plunder. What's your sentiments, Hurry, touching these pints?" "That you've made a vast mistake, old man, in calling savage blood human blood, at all. I think no more of a redskin's scalp than I do of a pair of wolf's ears, and would just as lief finger money for the one as for the other. With white people tea is different, for they've a natural aversion to being scalped, whereas your Indian shaves his head in readiness for the knife, and leaves a lock of hair by way of braggadocio, that one can lay hold of in the bargain. That's manly, however, and I felt from the first that we had only to get you on our side, to have your heart in hand," returned Tom, losing all his reserve, as he gained a renewed confidence in the disposition of his companions. "Something more may turn up from this inroad of the redskins than they bargained for. Deerslayer, I conclude you're of Hurry's way of thinking, and look upon money errand in this way as being as likely to pass as money errand in trapping or hunting." "I've no such feeling, nor any wish to harbor it, not I," returned the other. "My gifts are not scalper's gifts, but such as belong to my religion and color. I'll stand by you, old man, in the ark or in the castle, the canoe or the woods, but I'll not unhumanize my nature by falling into ways that God intended for another race. If you and Hurry have got any thoughts that lean towards the colony's gold, go by yourselves in search of it, and leave the females to my care. Much as I must differ from you both on all gifts that do not properly belong to a white man, we shall agree that it is the duty of the strong to take care of the weak, especially when the last belong to them that nature intended man to protect and console by his gentleness and strength." "Hurry, Harry, that is a lesson you might learn and practice on to some advantage," said the sweet, but spirited voice of Judith, from the cabin, a proof that she had overheard all that had hitherto been said. "No more of this, Jude," called out the father angrily. "Move farther off, we are about to talk of matters unfit for a woman to listen to." Hutter did not take any steps, however, to ascertain whether he was obeyed or not, but dropping his voice a little, he pursued the discourse. "The young man is right, Hurry,"
he said, and we can leave the children in his care. Now, my idea is just this, and I think you'll agree that it is rational and correct. There's a large party of these savages on shore and, though I didn't tell it before the girls, for they're womanish, and apt to be troublesome when anything like real work is to be done, there's women among them. This I know from Moccasin Prints, and T is likely they are hunters, after all, who have been out so long that they know nothing of the war, or of the bounties. In which case, Old Tom, why was their first salute an attempt to cut our throats? We don't know that their design was so bloody. It's natural and easy for an Indian to fall into ambushes and surprises, and, no doubt they wished to get on board the Ark first, and to make their conditions afterwards. That a disciplined savage should fire at us, is in rule, and I think nothing of that. Besides, how often they burned me out, and robbed my traps, and pulled trigger on me, in the most peaceful times. The blackguards will do such things, I must allow, and we pay them off pretty much in their own kind. Women would not be on the warpath, certainly, and, so far, there's reason in Uri Day. Nor would a hunter be in his war paint, returned Deerslayer. I saw the Mingos, and know that they are out on the trail of mortal men, and not for beaver or deer. There you have it again, old fellow, said Hurry. In the way of an eye, now, I'd as soon trust this young man, as trust the oldest settler in the colony, if he says paint, why paint it was. Then a hunting party and a war party have met, for women must have been with them. It's only a few days since the runner went through with the tidings of the troubles, and it may be that warriors have come out to call in their women and children, to get an early blow. That would stand the courts, and is just the truth, cried Hurry, you've got it now, old Tom, and I should like to hear what you mean to make out of it. The bounty, returned the other, looking up at his attentive companion in a cool, sullen manner, in which, however, heartless cupidity and indifference to the means were far more conspicuous than any feelings of animosity or revenge. If there's women, there's children, and big and little have scalps, the colony pays for all alike. More shame to it, that it should do so, interrupted Deerslayer, more shame to it, that it don't understand its gifts, and pay greater attention to the will of God. Hearken to reason, lad, and don't cry out afore you understand a case, returned the unmoved Hurry, the savages scalp your friends, the Delawares, or Mohicans whichever they may be, among the rest, and why shouldn't we scalp? I will own, it would be again right for you and me now, to go into the settlements and bring out scalps, but it's a very different matter as concerns Indians. A man shouldn't take scalps, if he isn't ready to be scalped, himself, on fitting occasions. One good turn deserves another, the world over. That's reason, and I believe it to be good religion. Eh, Master Hurry, again interrupted the rich voice of Judith, is it religion to say that one bad turn deserves another? I'll never reason again you, Judy, for you beat me with beauty, if you can't with sense. Here's the Canadas paying their Injuns for scalps, and why not we pay? Our Indians! Exclaimed the girl, laughing with a sort of melancholy merriment. Father, father! Think no more of this, and listen to the advice of Deerslayer, who has a conscience, which is more than I can say or think of Harry March. Hutter now rose, and, entering the cabin, he compelled his daughters to go into the adjoining room, when he secured both the doors, and returned. Then he and Hurry pursued the subject, but, as the purport of all that was material in this discourse will appear in the narrative, it need not be related here in detail. The reader, however, can have no difficulty in comprehending the morality that presided over their conference. It was, in truth, that which, in some form or other, rules most of the acts of men, and in which the controlling principle is that one wrong will justify another. Their enemies paid for scalps, and this was sufficient to justify the colony for retaliating. It is true, the French used the same argument, a circumstance, as Hurry took occasion to observe in answer to one of Deerslayer's objections, that proved its truth, as mortal enemies would not be likely to have recourse to the same reason unless it were a good one. But neither Hutter nor Hurry was a man likely to stick at trifles in matters connected with the right of the Aborigines, since it is one of the consequences of aggression that it hardens the conscience, as the only means of quieting it. In the most peaceable state of the country, a species of warfare was carried on between the Indians, especially those of the Canadas, and men of their caste, and the moment an actual and recognized warfare existed, it was regarded as the means of lawfully revenging a thousand wrongs, real and imaginary. Then, again, there was some truth, and a good deal of expediency, in the principle of retaliation, of which they both availed themselves, in particular, to answer the objections of their juster-minded and more scrupulous companion. You must fight a man with his own weapons, Deerslayer, cried Hurry,
in his uncouth dialect, and in his dogmatical manner of disposing of all oral propositions, if he's first you must be furser, if he's stout of heart, you must be stouter. This is the way to get the better of Christian or savage. By keeping up to this trail, you'll get soonest to the end of your journey. That's not Moravian doctrine, which teaches that all are to be judged according to their talents or learning, the engine like an engine, and the white man like a white man. Some of their teachers say, that if you're struck on the cheek, it's a duty to turn the other side of the face, and take another blow, instead of seeking revenge, whereby I understand. That's enough. Shouted Hurry, that's all I want, to prove a man's doctrine. How long would it take to kick a man through the colony in at one end and out at the other, on that principle? Don't mistake me, March, returned the young hunter, with dignity, I don't understand by this any more than that it's best to do this, if possible. Revenge is an Indian gift, and forgiveness a white man's. That's all. Overlook all you can is what's meant, and not revenge all you can. As for kicking, Master Hurry, and Deerslayer's sunburnt cheek flushed as he continued, into the colony, or out of the colony, that's neither here nor there, seeing no one proposes it, and no one would be likely to put up with it. What I wish to say is, that a redskin's scalping don't justify a paleface's scalping. Do as you're done by, Deerslayer, that's ever the Christian parson's doctrine. No, Hurry, I've asked the Moravians concerning that, and it's altogether different. Do as you would be done by, they tell me, is the true saying, while men practice the false. They think all the colonies wrong that offer bounties for scalps, and believe no blessing will follow the measures. Above all things, they forbid revenge. That for your Moravians! Cried March, snapping his fingers, they're the next thing to Quakers, and if you'd believe all they tell you, not even a rat would be skinned, out of Marcy. Whoever heard of Marcy on a muskrat? The disdainful manner of Hurry prevented a reply, and he and the old man resumed the discussion of their plans in a more quiet and confidential manner. This confidence lasted until Judith appeared, bearing the simple but savory supper. March observed, with a little surprise, that she placed the choicest bits before Deerslayer, and that in the little nameless attentions it was in her power to bestow, she quite obviously manifested a desire to let it be seen that she deemed him the honored guest. Accustomed, however, to the waywardness and coquetry of the beauty, this discovery gave him little concern, and he ate with an appetite that was in no degree disturbed by any moral causes. The easily digested food of the forest offering the fewest possible obstacles to the gratification of this great animal indulgence, Deerslayer, notwithstanding the hearty meal both had taken in the woods, was in no manner behind his companion in doing justice to the viands. An hour later the scene had greatly changed. The lake was still placid and glassy, but the gloom of the hour had succeeded to the soft twilight of a summer evening, and all within the dark setting of the woods lay in the quiet repose of night. The forests gave up no song, or cry, or even murmur, but looked down from the hills on the lovely basin they encircled, in solemn stillness, and the only sound that was audible was the regular dip of the sweeps, at which Hurry and Deerslayer lazily pushed, impelling the ark towards the castle. Hutter had withdrawn to the stern of the scow, in order to steer, but, finding that the young men kept even strokes, and held the desired course by their own skill, he permitted the oar to drag in the water, took a seat on the end of the vessel, and lighted his pipe. He had not been thus placed many minutes, ere Hattie came stealthily out of the cabin, or house, as they usually termed that part of the ark, and placed herself at his feet, on a little bench that she brought with her. As this movement was by no means unusual in his feeble-minded child, the old man paid no other attention to it than to lay his hand kindly on her head, in an affectionate and approving manner, an act of grace that the girl received in meek silence. After a pause of several minutes, Hetty began to sing. Her voice was low and tremulous, but it was earnest and solemn. The words and the tune were of the simplest form, the first being a hymn that she had been taught by her mother, and the last one of those natural melodies that find favor with all classes, in every age, coming from and being addressed to the feelings. Hutter never listened to this simple strain without finding his heart and manner softened, facts that his daughter well knew, and by which she had often profited, through the sort of holy instinct that enlightens the weak of mind, more especially in their aims toward good. Hetty's low, sweet tones had not been raised many moments, when the dip of the oar ceased, and the holy strain arose singly on the breathing silence of the wilderness. As if she gathered courage with the theme, her powers appeared to increase as she proceeded, and though nothing vulgar or noisy mingled in her melody, its strength and melancholy tenderness grew on the ear, until the air was filled with this simple homage of a soul that seemed almost spotless. That the men forward were not indifferent to this touching interruption, was proved by their inaction,
nor did their oars again dip until the last of the sweet sounds had actually died among the remarkable shores, which, at that witching hour, would waft even the lowest modulations of the human voice more than a mile. Hutter was much affected, for rude as he was by early habits, and even ruthless as he had got to be by long exposure to the practices of the wilderness, his nature was of that fearful mixture of good and evil that so generally enters into the moral composition of man. "You are sad tonight, child," said the father, whose manner and language usually assumed some of the gentleness and elevation of the civilized life he had led in youth, when he thus communed with this particular child. "We have just escaped from enemies, and ought rather to rejoice."
"You can never do it, father," said Hetty, in a low, remonstrating manner, taking his hard, knotty hand into both her own. "You have talked long with Harry March, but neither of you have the heart to do it.
This is going beyond your means, foolish child. You must have been naughty enough to have listened, for you could know nothing of our talk. Why should you and Harry kill people, especially women and children?"
"Peace, girl, peace. We are at war, and must do to our enemies as our enemies would do to us."
"That's not it, father. I heard Deerslayer say how it was. You must do to your enemies as you wish your enemies would do to you. No man wishes his enemies to kill him.
We kill our enemies in war, girl, lest they should kill us. One side or the other must begin, and them that begin first are most apt to get the victory. You know nothing about these things, poor Hetty, and had best say nothing."
"Judith says it is wrong, father, and Judith has sense, though I have none. Jude understands better than to talk to me of these matters, for she has sense, as you say, and knows I'll not bear it.
Which would you prefer, Hetty, to have your own scalp taken, and sold to the French, or that we should kill our enemies, and keep them from harming us?"
"That's not it, father. Don't kill them, nor let them kill us. Sell your skins, and get more, if you can, but don't sell human blood."
"Come, come, child, let us talk of matters you understand. Are you glad to see our old friend, March, back again? You like Harry, and must know that one day he may be your brother, if not something nearer."
"That can't be, father," returned the girl, after a considerable pause. "Harry has had one father, and one mother, and people never have two."
"So much for your weak mind, Hetty. When Jude marries, her husband's father will be her father, and her husband's sister her sister. If she should marry Harry, then he will be your brother."
"Judith will never have Harry," returned the girl mildly, but positively, "Judith don't like Harry."
"That's more than you can know, Hetty. Harry March is the handsomest, and the strongest, and the boldest young man that ever visits the lake, and, as Jude is the greatest beauty, I don't see why they shouldn't come together. He has as much as promised that he will enter into this job with me, on condition that I'll consent."
Hetty began to move her body back and forth, and otherwise to express mental agitation, but she made no answer for more than a minute. Her father, accustomed to her manner, and suspecting no immediate cause of concern, continued to smoke with the apparent phlegm which would seem to belong to that particular species of enjoyment.
"Harry is handsome, father," said Hetty, with a simple emphasis that she might have hesitated about using, had her mind been more alive to the inferences of others.
"I told you so, child," muttered old Hutter, without removing the pipe from between his teeth. "He's the likeliest youth in these parts, and Jude is the likeliest young woman I've met with since her poor mother was in her best days.
Is it wicked to be ugly, father?"
"One might be guilty of worse things, but you're by no means ugly, though not so comely as Jude."
"Is Judith any happier for being so handsome?"
"She may be, child, and she may not be. But talk of other matters now, for you hardly understand these, poor Hetty. How do you like our new acquaintance, Deerslayer?"
"He isn't handsome, father. Harry is far handsomer than Deerslayer."
"That's true, but they say he is a noted hunter. His fame had reached me before I ever saw him, and I did hope he would prove to be as stout a warrior as he is dexterous with the deer. All men are not alike, howsoever, child, and it takes time, as I know by experience, to give a man a true wilderness heart."
"Have I got a wilderness heart, father?" "And Harry, is his heart true wilderness?"
"You sometimes ask queer questions, Hetty. Your heart is good, child, and fitter for the settlements than for the woods, while your reason is fitter for the woods than for the settlements."
"Why has Judith more reason than I, father?"
"Heaven help thee, child, this is more than I can answer. God gives sense, and appearance, and all these things, and he grants them as he seeth fit.
Dost thou wish for more sense?"
"Not I. The little I have troubles me, for when I think the hardest, then I feel the unhappiest. I don't believe thinking is good for me, though I do wish I was as handsome as Judith."
Why so, poor child? Thy sister's beauty may cause her trouble, as it caused her mother before her. It's no advantage, Hetty, to be so marked for anything as to become an object of envy, or to be sought after more than others.
Mother was good, if she was handsome, returned the girl, the tears starting to her eyes, as usually happened when she adverted to her deceased parent.
Old Hutter, if not equally affected, was moody and silent at this allusion to his wife. He continued smoking, without appearing disposed to make any answer, until his simple-minded daughter repeated her remark, in a way to show that she felt uneasiness lest he might be inclined to deny her assertion. Then he knocked the ashes out of his pipe, and laying his hand in a sort of rough kindness on the girl's head, he made a reply.
"Thy mother was too good for this world," he said, "though others might not think so. Her good looks did not befriend her, and you have no occasion to mourn that you are not as much like her as your sister. Think less of beauty, child, and more of your duty, and you'll be as happy on this lake as you could be in the king's palace."
"I know it, father, but Hurry says beauty is everything in a young woman." Hutter made an ejaculation expressive of dissatisfaction, and went forward, passing through the house in order to do so. Hetty's simple betrayal of her weakness in behalf of March gave him uneasiness on a subject concerning which he had never felt before, and he determined to come to an explanation at once with his visitor, for directness of speech and decision in conduct were two of the best qualities of this rude being, in whom the seeds of a better education seemed to be constantly struggling upwards, to be choked by the fruits of a life in which his hard struggles for subsistence and security had steeled his feelings and indurated his nature. When he reached the forward end of the scow, he manifested an intention to relieve Deerslayer at the oar, directing the latter to take his own place aft. By these changes, the old man and Hurry were again left alone, while the young hunter was transferred to the other end of the ark. Hetty had disappeared when Deerslayer reached his new post, and for some little time he directed the course of the slow-moving craft by himself. It was not long, however, before Judith came out of the cabin, as if disposed to do the honors of the place to a stranger engaged in the service of her family. The starlight was sufficient to permit objects to be plainly distinguished when near at hand, and the bright eyes of the girl had an expression of kindness in them, when they met those of the youth, that the latter was easily enabled to discover. Her rich hair shaded her spirited and yet soft countenance, even at that hour rendering it the more beautiful as the rose is loveliest when reposing amid the shadows and contrasts of its native foliage. Little ceremony is used in the inner course of the woods, and Judith had acquired a readiness of address, by the admiration that she so generally excited, which, if it did not amount to forwardness, certainly in no degree lent to her charms the aid of that retiring modesty on which poets love to dwell.
"I thought I should have killed myself with laughing, Deerslayer," the beauty abruptly but coquettishly commenced, "when I saw that Indian dive into the river. He was a good-looking savage, too." The girl always dwelt on personal beauty as a sort of merit, and yet one couldn't stop to consider whether his paint would stand water.
"And I thought they would have killed you with their weapons, Judith," returned Deerslayer. "It was an awful risk for a female to run in the face of a dozen Mingos."
"Did that make you come out of the cabin, in spite of their rifles, too?" asked the girl, with more real interest than she would have cared to betray, though with an indifference of manner that was the result of a good deal of practice united to native readiness. "Men aren't he apt to see females in danger, and not come to their assistance. Even a Mingo knows that." This sentiment was uttered with as much simplicity of manner as of feeling, and Judith rewarded it with a smile so sweet, that even Deerslayer, who had imbibed a prejudice against the girl in consequence of Hurry's suspicions of her levity, felt its charm, notwithstanding half its winning influence was lost in the feeble light. It at once created a sort of confidence between them, and the discourse was continued on the part of the hunter, without the lively consciousness of the character of this coquette of the wilderness, with which it had certainly commenced. "You are a man of deeds, and not of words, I see plainly, Deerslayer," continued the beauty, taking her seat near the spot where the other stood, "and I foresee we shall be very good friends. Hurry has a tongue, and, giant as he is, he talks more than he performs.
March is your friend, Judith, and friends should be tender of each other, when apart. We all know what Hurry's friendship comes to. Let him have his own way in everything, and he's the best fellow in the colony, but head him off, as you say of the deer, and he is master of everything near him but himself. Hurry is no favorite of mine, Deerslayer, and I dare say, if the truth was known, and his conversation about me repeated, it would be found that he thinks no better of me than I own I do of him." The latter part of this speech was not uttered without uneasiness. Had the girl's companion been more sophisticated, he might have observed the averted face, the manner in which the pretty little foot was agitated, and other signs that, for some unexplained reason, The opinions of March were not quite as much a matter of indifference to her as she thought fit to pretend. Whether this was no more than the ordinary working of female vanity, feeling keenly even when it affected not to feel at all, or whether it proceeded from that deeply seated consciousness of right and wrong which God Himself has implanted in our breasts that we may know good from evil, will be made more apparent to the reader as we proceed in the tale. Deerslayer felt embarrassed. He well remembered the cruel imputations left by March's distrust, and, while he did not wish to injure his associate's suit by exciting resentment against him, his tongue was one that literally knew no guile. To answer without saying more or less than he wished, was consequently a delicate duty. March has his say of all things in nature, whether a friend or foe, slowly and cautiously rejoined the hunter. He's one of them that speak as they feel while the tongue's a-going, and that's sometimes different from what they'd speak if they took time to consider. Give me a Delaware, Judith, for one that reflects and ruminates on his a-day. Enmity has made him thoughtful, and a loose tongue is no recommend at their council fires. I dare say March's tongue goes free enough when it gets on the subject of Judith Hutter and her sister, said the girl, rousing herself as if in careless disdain. Young women's good names are a pleasant matter of discourse with some that wouldn't dare be so open-mouthed if there was a brother in the way. Master March may find it pleasant to traduce us, but sooner or later he'll repent. Nay, Judith, this is taking the matter up too much in earnest. Hurry has never whispered a syllable again the good name of Hetty, to begin with. I see how it is, I see how it is, impetuously interrupted Judith. I am the one he sees fit to scorch with his withering tongue. Hetty, indeed. Poor Hetty. She continued, her voice sinking into low, husky tones, that seemed nearly to stifle her in the utterance, she is beyond and above his slanderous malice. Poor Hetty. If God has created her feeble-minded, the weakness lies altogether on the side of errors of which she seems to know nothing. The earth never held a purer being than Hetty Hutter, Deerslayer. I can believe it, yes, I can believe that, Judith, and I hope earnestly that the same can be said of her handsome sister. There was a soothing sincerity in the voice of Deerslayer, which touched the girl's feelings, nor did the allusion to her beauty lessen the effect with one who only knew too well the power of her personal charms. Nevertheless, the still, small voice of conscience was not hushed, and it prompted the answer which she made, after giving herself time to reflect. I dare say Harry had some of his vile hints about the people of the garrisons, she added. He knows they are gentlemen, and can never forgive anyone for being what he feels he can never become himself. Not in the sense of a king's officer, Judith, certainly,